put together as a tool to catch votes. They have questioned why, you know, since the government took office, this is the time they are having to put out a tracker in an election year. Also, 48 hours after the launch of this particular tracker, 67 mistakes or errors were discovered, and the Information Ministry says that they have taken steps to take out those errors or those inputs from the tracker. The point is, who validated those and why should those be there? Is a point about a tracker even necessary at all? If there's a project government has done, the community people will see those projects. Why should there be a tracker? Or why shouldn't there be a tracker to inform people generally of the holistic job of government across the country? This is our discussion today. Also, cocoa has been in the news for a number of issues. The NDC and MPP, or the cocoa board, have been at it for the better part of the week and even a week before. The accusation is that government is shortchanging cocoa farmers. The government says no, it's because the NDC does not appear to appreciate the issues properly. But also, cocoa production is at its lowest in the last decade or so, producing just above 600,000 tons. We used to produce about 1 million tons. What has happened? People have blamed factors such as galamsey, etc., for this. We will look at this and see what will happen to that particular sector that has been described as a renewable one, largely described as better than even the oil fine, because that is not renewable. This is our discussion. I'll take a short break. I'll return, provide some updates, and then we will get a discussion underway. Once again, you're welcome. You're welcome back to The Big Issue. My name is Salom Adunu, your platform for incisive analysis and riveting conversation. We're looking at two key issues. Government launched a performance tracker that it says it hopes that this will bring transparency and democratize the process the more, make people know what government is using their monies for, and generally give them a sense of what government has been up to for the past 7 or so years. Others have described this as a vote-catching tool. A number of things have been put in there, a number of jobs created, the impact of free SHS, certain key projects across the country, etc. We will look at all of that and see. But government also has admitted that there were some errors. About 67 of the projects or inputs there were erroneous. Government said so yesterday on their social media handles. That sent a lot of tongues wagging. We will deal with all of that as well. Cocoa is on the table. There's been some issues about the producer price and all of that, the production, how much we produce in the past year and how that compares with what we've been seeing or we used to see in the past, what has happened to the sector, why the sector appears to be struggling. We will deal with that. But before we delve into the matters properly, let me just give you some updates on what we are up to. Now, the Minister for Works and Housing, Kojo Opon-Krumah, has revealed that a newly launched performance tracker is aimed at ensuring transparency and accountability in the execution of infrastructure projects across the country. He added that the tracker will help address outstanding concerns about the accuracy and reliability of project presentations, particularly the use of axis impressions to depict outcomes. Speaking at official launch of the tracker at the Ghana Institute of Management and Public Administration, GIMPA, on Wednesday, Opon-Krumah said the tracker currently hosts over 13,000 projects nationwide.
August 18, 2020, Vice President Dr. Mahmoud Bawumia introduced the Delivery Tracker as a website to monitor the Akufo-Addo government's infrastructure projects across the country. During the State of Nations address in Parliament on February 27, President Akufo-Addo announced the launch of a performance tracker to address the long-standing concerns about the accuracy and reliability of information on government's projects. Launching the tracker on behalf of government, the Minister for Works and Housing, Kojo Opon-Krumah, emphasized the importance of maintaining standards and delivering tangible results.
The question remains, from 2020 till now, what does my government do with my money? A lot of work has gone on, as Professor Piedu mentioned, and that work is what has led us to what we call today the performance tracker, or what some will call the tracker 2.0. The URL we read performancetracker.gov.gh. So what is the performance tracker? The performance tracker is, first of all, a database. It's a database that showcases the performance of the government of Ghana. And it showcases it through various projects that have been executed across the 261 districts. And this database has two interfaces. One is a website. So you can go onto that website, www.performancetracker.gov.gh, and you can access that database. The other is an app. Today, the mobile phone is a very powerful tool. And what it does is that it showcases the performance of the government of Ghana across the 261 districts, across the 28 ministries, and across the 16 regions. Now, it's an enhanced version of the 2020 tracker that the government put out.
The Minister Designate for Information, Fatima Abubakar, highlighted the role of the tracker as a fact checker for government's project. She encouraged stakeholders to access the platform and provide accurate feedback to enhance the effectiveness in showcasing government's achievement in various districts.
In an era of misinformation and disinformation, it is so easy for someone to sit on any platform and say, in my district, government has done nothing. But we know that we have not put DCEs there with allocations of district assembly common fund and IGFNs and special projects, and over 7 to 8 years period, not a single project has been done. We have taken the narrative into our own hands to make sure we tell the story and empower all Ghanaians in the media, CSOs, academia, and the general public to take the pain to navigate the platform to see the project themselves. If because it's a digital platform, you are not so sure, but you want to proceed to visit the communities, you are welcome. We are even more interested in your feedback because we are confident in the data that we have put there.
All right, so that was the launch of the performance tracker, which details a number of things. Free SHS, road networks, hospitals, Agenda 111, and all of that. Things that government has been up to generally. My guest to help us with the discussion this morning, Edem Agbana, former Deputy National Youth Organizer of the NDC, also a parliamentary candidate for the Ketu North constituency of the Volta region. He is from the NDC. Asielu Kokro, the Deputy National Communications Director of the New Patriotic Party, the governing party, is also with us in the studio. Kofi Asare, Executive Director, Africa Education Watch, is with us as well. A lot of information on education and all of that. Then I'm Profi Ajekum, Senior Research Associate with Imani Africa. These are my guests for the first part of the program this morning. Gentlemen, you are welcome to the show. I started with you, Kokro, since you represent the governing New Patriotic Party. Why was this so important? Why is it so important to design or come up with the performance tracker? People know what government is doing. If I lived in a particular area and there's a hospital or there's a road, I see it. Why is it important to tell me in a tracker what you've been up to?
Thank you. I think that, good morning to your viewers, and good morning to the Honorable Minister for Information, Designate, and the team at the Vice President Office, for us to be able to launch this performance tracker. Salam, I'm at the National Comm Directorate, and I've been profiling reports from political actors, journalists, people from the academia, looking at how much government has spent and the amount that we have borrowed, what have you used the money for. So basically, prior to the 2020 presidential elections, we launched the delivery tracker, and then we believe that we need to account to the Ghanaian people. Mm. Accountability is very key in this democratic dispensation. So with the Vice President Office tasked a team to look at the projects that we have done, improve upon the delivery tracker that was launched in 2020, and then we launched the performance tracker last week, Wednesday. Salom, it's important that because of misinformation and disinformation in the Ghanaian system, you are highly conscious, you have time to read to news and you're listening, Sometimes when you hear something, you do critical thinking, you do fast check. But how many Ghanaians can do fast check? So it's prudent on the part of government to be able to put together the projects that we have been able to accomplish or achieved within 7 years, 4 months. So basically, if you look at it, it's very nice. And we need to applaud the government. We are improving our democracy. I think that previously governments will publish their accomplishments or achievements in books. How many people can access the books or pamphlets? Few people can access. I quite remember when MPP formed government in 2001, Kofor's time, we published a lot of projects in some of the books and our manifestos, what we have done and the rest, and what when we get another opportunity, what we will do. So look, if you look at this performance tracker, it is digitized. Everybody can access it, online and app. It's a great innovation, and to be able to bring on board more than 13,000 government projects. In your intro, you talked about 67 errors that people have looked at. Indeed, data entry, when you enter mass data onto a system, obviously there will be some errors. The errors are not so massive that if you take percentage of it, 13,000 plus projects, and then we have identified about 67 of them, and I want to assure your viewers and your listeners this morning that the team is rectifying all the errors that have been identified by the Ghanaian people. But we need to applaud the government. We have done well. We need to account 7 years, 4 months, what we have done. And we have done monumental things. If you go to the performance tracker, we have 22 teams, 106 categories, 30 ministries accounting what they have used their money for. And again, see all the city regions down to the districts, more than 260 municipal metropolitan assemblies, what we have done. Chiefs compounds, schools, and the rest is there. Then this tracker, we have done some statistical analysis, what we call metrics. We have been able to do some comparative analysis as to for the previous, when the Ghanaian people gave us a mandate and what we have done, and then we'll do some flashback to compare the existing prior to we form a government. So if you look at it, about 863 statistical metrics, strong one, based upon source. Indeed, if you go into the tracker, you do due diligence, all the sources have been quoted. So if some people want to be mischief, if one or two outlier things occur, you cannot use it to rubbish this powerful.
You said that the tracker was launched to assist us deal with issues of misinformation.
Fantastic. And then we'll be able to account to the Ghanaian people.
That's important.
Yeah.
But in inputting the data, what you've done is also to more or less, I won't say deceive the people, because if just 48 hours after the launch of the tracker, 67 errors meaning projects which were either not there or projects you said you had completed which you have not completed, they are erroneous.
Yeah,
so
you see,
how does that fit in your
you see, Salo, when you enter mass data onto a system, I don't know your level of IT compliance, but when you enter mass data, obviously there will be some challenge, especially coming from ministries, departments, and agencies. So when these errors are detected, they are not massive. Mm. So we are looking at the percentage.
But is it not worrying that just 48 hours? Oh, God, there are 13,000 entries.
In 48 hours, it tells you
13,000
entries.
I'm telling you that any single individual has been able to go through all 13,000.
Oh, let me tell you, those who have been.
I have not been able to.
You're fantastic. But those who are very critical.
67.
Yeah, you see, I've been reading the commentary after the lunch. Those who have been very critical of the app, obviously. If they have identified more, we'll be seeing.
But
what I'm saying is
what I'm saying is, it's one person cannot just sit down and go through.
Oh, I understand what you are saying.
No.
So what, the point, that is why.
Just relax.
No, maybe if you allow me to make a certain point.
You're talking and we have to interrogate the issues. What it means is that, for example, I can't just sit here and know what is there and what is wrong or what is erroneous or not. Because if I want to do it at CTFM, I'll have to contact my regional correspondents, stringers across the country that see Ashanti region, maybe Ejiso, this particular project, or these are the things they've said. Can you check for me and see? It takes time. But is it not alarming that within 48 hours, 67 have been identified.
It's not alarming. We said that it's a work in progress. The errors that I've identified to me is not alarming. We should applaud the government to be able to come out of this great initiative. So the errors are not alarming. Salom, it's not alarming.
Very well.
Yeah, and I want to assure you that by close of maybe Monday, you go to the system, what have been identified, they have rectified it. So we need to look at it.
Okay.
And we have talking about, people are saying that, why should we spend resources, it's a misplaced priority. No, it's not a misplaced priority. We need to account. We are talking about accountability. Those people, our donor partners who have been giving us funding, World Bank giving us a lot of funding, the educational sector, WHO, and other bilateral agencies giving funding to us. They need to be able to know what we have done. And that is why, in quantitative terms, we have been able to present what we have done with the money that we have collected, especially donor funding and common taxpayers' money. Hmm. And people are amazed. People are amazed. Just that people want to do political mischief. Yeah, but if people want to do proper critique of their performance tracker based upon empirical analysis, not on conjectures, not political, to be able to score political points, but they stay focused and be able to let us do a fair judgment analysis, I think, Salom, this is a game changer for our democracy.
Very
and we need to applaud
in this election, one word which is buzzing is game changer.
It's a game changer.
That's fine.
Because, you see, Salom, many people, the last time,
I'll come back.
For instance, when we went to Sami Western North with the vice president, people said that MPP, we have done a lot of things, the government has done, so why are we not talking? We publish what we have done, the accumulated accomplishments. Now the Ghanaian people, some are saying that it's a misplaced priority. You understand? So I don't know.
The Ghanaian people, some are saying. So, if some of the Ghanaian people are saying, so
you see, if you go to the tracker also, we have been able to do, as I indicated to you, we have done some analysis of the projects that we have done, not putting normal figures there. You can track it, look at the location of the project, everything is there. The errors, we are rectifying it. What they have brought, the team have been able to look at it.
Very well.
So it's a work in progress.
Nice one. So, Adam, the government must be transparent, and government must let us know what it is using our money for. That's accountability. The hallmark of any good government is accountability, transparency, and all of that. This tracker seeks to do that. So, for example, if you are not sure whether some loan government took for a particular project somewhere in my village or somewhere, with the help of this tracker, you can key in the project they said they were going to do, and you see the level of completion of the project, whether it's there or not, you will know. If it's not there, you can raise issues that you said you're going to use this amount of money for this, for which you contracted this loan. Where is it? You can raise questions. That's accountability. So this obviously should be great, and it's a national tool, as Opon Nkrumah said at the launch, and we should be applauding it, shouldn't we?
Salam, good morning to you and to my senior brothers on the panel this morning. And let me say good morning to all our cherished viewers and listeners across the world, and a special good morning to the good people of Ketu North. And let me use the opportunity to once again thank them for their support and encouragement since I was elected parliamentary candidate. Accountability is very important, and it is one of the key ingredients of good governance. That where we are today, it is important for government to provide the citizenry with information on projects and policy decisions and even outcomes of those decisions. And so there is nothing wrong with the government deciding to launch a performance tracker. When the NDC was in power, we introduced what we call the Green Book. But even before the Green Book, we established an office called the Presidential Delivery Unit, which was headed by Dr. Valerie Sawyer at the point. And that office or that unit at the presidency kept track of all government's projects and promises and all that, and what we're delivering to the good people of Ghana. And so there is nothing wrong that the Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo and Dr. Bawumia government has decided to launch what we call a performance tracker to inform or let the people of Ghana know what they have been doing since they were elected into power in 2017. But Selom, I've had the opportunity to go through the performance tracker. And I have a few concerns. Number one is for us to first define that what really must constitute a central government's accountability. What should constitute? And so when you look at the Green Book, and let me correct the impression that this is the first time we are having this kind of thing on online or on a digital platform. In fact, at the time the Green Book was launched in 2015, we had a website which provided online content and which was regularly updated on new projects that were completed and all of that. Even at the back of the Green Book, you find websites that contained, the first one was the Ministry of Communications, .gov.gh, www.ghana.gov.gh, all of this.
It wasn't a dedicated website for the projects.
No, like but even the Green Book, even the Green Book had a dedicated online platform, had a dedicated platform. And so the likes of Honorable Felix Ofosu-Kwakye and co kept updating this place, these pages and platforms for people to see, because we are aware that indeed after you launched the book, and this book was launched in December 2015, we had many other projects that were initiated and that came after. And so it is important to keep updating the people. So this is not the first time we are having a performance tracker of a sort, or government putting out its projects online. This is not the first time. But I want us to pay attention to some key issues. And like I mentioned, the first one is, what should constitute a government's project, a central government's accountability project? Because I looked through the list, and then you see they are bragging about the numbers, 13,000. When you go deep into the numbers and you look at what they have here on their platforms, even when an MP refurbishes a school building using the MP's common fund, they are listed as projects undertaken by the government. Projects undertaken by district assemblies, and some of them are very, very small projects. As you, when we are talking about central government, we look at the big things. We look at the significant projects that have national or nationwide relevance. And so when the district assembly in my locality constructs a 4-unit toilet, and that is listed by the government as an achievement that we must celebrate, I think that we are delving into the realm of mediocrity.
But governments are elected to solve problems. If a particular community has sanitation problems and government deals with that, using the district assembly won't do it with the MCE's pocket money or personal money. He would have done it with the money from the people or the taxes, etc., that would be allocated to him. So it's okay, isn't it?
Selom, it is okay when governments decide to solve problems at the local level. In fact, that is what they are elected to do. It is okay when the district assembly resolves challenges with sanitation, challenges with education, or in any other sector. It is okay when government or the district assembly does that. But when the central government is giving you an account of what they have done, and then they brag about the numbers and create the impression that between 2017 and 2020, we have, or 2024, we have undertaken 13,000 projects. It is unprecedented. It has never happened before. And based on those small projects at the district is what they are using for the accounting, then equally we must be able to get into it. Because when you look at the Green Book, all the projects stated here in this Green Book are major central government initiated projects. These are not district assembly projects. So if the NDC had decided to put into the Green Book public toilets, boreholes that were drilled, and all of that, I am telling you, the NDC has won
may have recorded nothing less than 40,000 or 50,000 projects. But you have a government reporting what they have done. Central government. And that is it. If at the district level, my MCE decides to give me an account of what they have done with the funds that have come into their coffers as a municipality or as a district, I will have no problem when they report of boreholes that they have drilled or they give me account of schools that they have refurbished. Mm. But I have a problem that central government takes some of those projects at the district level to create an impression that they have done something that has never been done before. And we'll go into it. Public toilets here and there. And schools. Refurbishment of schools and projects that are not even completed, they have recorded as completed. Mm. My second challenge, Selom, has to do with the misinformation. Now, you launch a tracker and you claim the tracker is to help cure mischief and disinformation, is to provide accurate information. And in less than 48 hours, we have exposed you. Then you have gone back to say you made mistakes with entry about 67. But the truth is that it is not the system itself that identified the mistake that they made. These are the issues that we raised. And so, but for the fact that we raised issues with a certain project they listed that had been completed on Bishop Herman campus, they would not have come out to say that indeed it was entered wrongly. So it begs the question, how or what processes did the Ministry of Information go through in order to validate the projects that they listed? It means that somebody didn't do his work right. Is that not it? Because if you as a ministry, after several all sorts of speech and stuff about this so-called performance tracker, after investing so much into it, then right after you launch the project, people are now pointing out the mistakes or the so-called mistakes. The people are now pointing out the deceptive content about the performance tracker. Then you come back and you are telling us that you made a mistake and those ones will be corrected. It tells you that they are not even being sincere. They are not honest with their output.
They put in 13,000 and more projects. I mean, if a few of them, less than 1%, happens to be erroneous, is it not something you can forgive?
No. Let me tell you why this can't be forgiven and why we must delve deep into this issue. Tell them, how did they collect information on the 13? It didn't come from the central government. What I know for a fact is that all the districts were asked to provide an update on projects completed within the period that we're talking about, the period under consideration. So all of them provided. And so we must be interested in finding out how did that move from the district assembly level, pass through the region, go to the national office, and it still made its way into the tracker without anybody identifying that indeed those projects are not what they identified. And so somebody must be held accountable for misinformation, but for the fact that we exposed. And as we speak, the 67 that they talk about are the ones that people who had the opportunity to go through the tracker, took pictures and shared on social media. Those are the ones that they claim were erroneous. The question is that how many more when we decide to go through? Because like you said, it's been even a busy week. Many people are not even able to go through all the 13,000 projects. And so the second thing is that government was not meticulous enough in their attempt, in their haste, to put out information to impress. They decided to put out a lot of content that is not a true representation.
But to be fair, at the launch, I think Opon Kumar did say that it's a platform. I mean, it will be constantly updated. There will be a feedback portion. And that should mean that there will be one or two things which are not as they are. And so once that feedback is given, they will correct it.
No, you see, when you have a government that when they were in opposition criticized the Green Book and created the erroneous impression that the Green Book had certain pictures or projects that in reality was non-existent, you would expect them to elevate or do better. Now, we have here, and I intentionally brought the Green Book, the MPP communicators, MPP foot soldiers, ministers, all of them have been claiming that projects in the Green Book are either artistic impressions or projects that are not there in reality. Today, I have brought a copy, and I will appreciate, I will give a copy to my brother from the NPP to identify a single project in the Green Book that is not there in reality. They will not be able to tell you. But for the sake of propaganda, they will say all of those things. But here, on your tracker, we have identified, and we keep identifying many projects that you have listed that is not really the impression. Again, we also have a situation where, especially under the 1D1F project. Now, when you say a factory is 100% complete or completed, what do you mean? At what point do we refer to a factory as 100% completed? For example, you come to Ketunot. They claim that they have put together a cassava processing factory in my constituency. Now, all you see somewhere in the constituency is a building that has been abandoned for several months or years. The place has been built, or a place has been constructed or built, kept under lock and key. When you go there today, the place is very bushy. Nothing is going on there. And yet you list it as a factory that has been completed. And so what is really the essence? Because when you put up a structure, then you lock it, and you tell us that it's a factory that you have...
is clear that some work has been done.
What is the work? At what point has it become a factory? So I can put together something that looks like a three-bedroom, but they have put the 100% complete.
It could be 10%. So that's an error. But some work has been done with our money.
You see, Selom, this is the point. You promised me that you are going to put together, or you are going to construct, a cassava processing factory. That is the promise. And when you made this promise, you come back and you tell me that you have completed the cassava processing factory. And I'm telling you that all you see at the site is a building, a structure. Whether it has the right machinery, whether it has what is needed to operate, all of that is not even under conversation, it's not under discussion. For 7 months, years, the place has been kept under lock and key. The entire place has now been engulfed by bush. It has become a place where rodents are playing freely. It has become a playground for rodents. And you call that in your tracker a factory that you have completed. And I'm asking, at what point does it become a factory? Is it when it is operational?
The structure is what we refer to.
You see, the mediocrity of this government is too much.
Very well.
Let us to celebrate mediocrity. And yet, you listen to all these projects, misinformation, many of the things that have been listed here, some fact check reveals that are not even true. But I'm sure when we come back to the second round, I will delve deep into the jobs that they claim they have created in that tracker. But for now, to conclude, the tracker is nothing but a mediocre attempt by government to paint a picture that they have done well. Meanwhile, that is not the reality on the ground.
I see. So that's it, Magbana. Parliamentary candidate for Ketunot. Kofi, I know your focus, really. I mean, you don't want to dabble in a lot of those things. But once you run a CSO, accountability is important, transparency is important. Let me take your initial view on government's performance tracker. They need to be open to the populace, the taxpayers, etc., on what government is used our money for. Your initial thoughts on the performance tracker, and if you have any other thing to say about that, you add it before we proceed.
Well, thank you, Salam. I think it is great to have a performance tracker that enables citizens to assess information on how government has used their taxes. And so I will commend the government for initiating the second phase of the performance tracker. I also want to indicate that it is also important for us to appreciate that a performance tracker is not needed necessarily because of misinformation and disinformation. If the philosophy underpinning the performance tracker are these two, then we have a little challenge here. You see, this is how democracy as a system of governance work. Citizens surrender their right to be governed to the government, the sovereign, to govern them. And then they expect the delivery of goods and services, the delivery of governance, including social and economic and political governance, in return from the sovereign. Those services will improve the lives of the citizens. But it is not until citizens are able to demand accountability from the government they elected that these deliverables will happen and affect positively their lifestyles, their living standards. And so democracy is designed to be a symbiotic animal. Participation must be dual. You go and vote for governments, and then you demand accountability from them. Of course, you commit to other responsibilities as a citizen. You pay your taxes, you are law-abiding, and then you demand accountability. Without information, citizens, after voting for their government, cannot have the critical ingredients to demand accountability from their government. Now, what information do citizens need from government after electing them? What information do citizens need from government after paying their taxes to them? The first is information on how government uses their money. Now, that information is not needed at the end of a regime. That information is not needed at the completion of a project. That information is not needed when a project has been completed. That is not when the citizen must be informed. In my last visit to Porto Alegre and Brazil, you know, some municipalities in Brazil, to study how participatory budgeting and citizens' engagement has taken place or takes place at the municipal level, I learned one thing, that in many of the municipalities, including Sao Paulo, at the beginning of every financial year, local governments present their plans to the populace through various platforms. In this year, this is how much we have allocated . This is the location of the project, and this is the expected benefit the project is supposed to bring to the people. So citizens at the beginning are aware of what government is doing with their money this year. Okay. But here is the case. In that case, citizens have the information they need to monitor how government procures that goods or services. If it's a school building, if it's a hospital, it's a KVIP, they are informed from the beginning to demand accountability in the way the good or the service is procured. We live in a country today where single source procurement is the norm. Our president was a champion of competitive procurement when he was in opposition. On every platform, he never missed an opportunity to rubbish the normalized single source procurement or non-competitive procurement under the NDC regime. But since the government took over, single source has become the norm everywhere. You understand? And it means that our president appreciated that competitive procurement provided some value for money that single source procurement wouldn't. That's why he was a chief advocate of competitive procurement when he was in opposition. So if citizens have access to such information at the beginning, they are able to influence how their local assemblies procure. They are able to influence how their national governments procure, their ministries procure these goods and services. One, two. And when contracts are awarded, they are able to follow through and monitor to ensure that the right quality of goods and services are delivered and at the right time. Citizens' participation, it's not only needed when you have finished the project. Now, what can they do about the project? It's done. How much did you do it? Are we told on the platform? No. How did you procure? Are we told on the platform? No. What is the case of value for money? Are we told? No. Just that we have built this. We are aware of a lot of procurement issues that have emerged in this country, some leading to the dismissal or resignation of the PPA, the former PPA boss. I'm sure all those projects that were involved in those controversies, if they have been completed, would have been published here. Okay, so it is great for government to publish how it has used citizens' taxes through a tracker, easily accessible to all citizens. It is great. It has always been great since Kufuor and since Mills Mahama era. This digital platform makes it easier to access. And I see an attempt, I see a strategy for an expansive reporting, not only on projects that government directly funded, but also the projects that government facilitated. And also governments that not only central government procured, but also local governments procured. They are all government achievements, central or local. And so they must be documented. The Green Book and President Kufuor's book centered on key major projects, we know. But this one goes to talk about all the little projects in every district. It is great. But it shouldn't be the case that when it's an election year, we bring information about completed projects to the people. Because it's an election year.
But to be fair, I get the point.
And then it should also be that we bring it to them and tell them that we are bringing it to you because of the possibility of being misinformed or disinformed.
And accountability and transparency.
There's no accountability after this. The thing is
accountability, you go back to the people. I mean, for elections.
That's the point I'm talking about. Exactly. Accountability is not a finish. It's not an end. And been implemented. Because a lot of things that could have changed in terms of quality, I have seen a lot of, and I've been working across the country for decades. You see projects like market projects constructed and not used. You see school buildings constructed. Last year, there was a school building in Boatinkrum, in Asante Achimera, Boatinkrum, completed about 4 years, still not opened. Children were not able to access the school building.
There's a number of bungalows at the Bruegels.
Exactly.
Completed, still not been used.
Okay. But all those projects would normally have been reported as completed projects. But a school building is built to enhance access, not to be there.
So the access is not there, the impact of the project is zero.
But I'm coming back to the point where if citizens were involved in demanding accountability from the formative stages of that, from the inception of that project, through the monitoring, it wouldn't have happened that the project was even started at the wrong place. But almost here, after building it, what can you do? You understand? So it is more beneficial to citizens when the information government is giving us today, including information on budgets and procurement, is made available to citizens at the beginning of such projects so that citizens are able to complement government efforts to monitor, to ensure quality implementation, value for money, and ensure that the projects are completed within real time. This, for me, is the addition to the performance tracker. But the idea of having a performance tracker is great and should never be done every 4 years when we are in election year. It is great. And so the reason why it is great is the same reason why it must be done, it must be updated annually. The 2021 that was launched should have been updated every quarter, you understand, so that citizens will not, there won't be any funding launch again. It's there, you go there. There are many such platforms in many of the agencies. You go there and it's been updated. If you go to the Ministry of Education, they have the MS platform. They updated it every day with development in the sector. We don't wait for 4 years. And so that should be the approach of central and local government in reporting on projects and progress.
How about a conversation that it's not necessarily a finished projects? There are projects with varying levels of completion.
I don't buy into that conversation.
50%, 60%.
Yes, I've seen that conversation. That this project was started by another regime. For me, that if I hear that the government has continued another government's project, that's the government I'm more likely to vote for. And be honest with you as a citizen.
I see the one that continued.
Yes, because the greatest source of financial waste in this country, if you are reading the Auditor General's report, are the projects that are lost through political transitions. In the training colleges alone, now College of Education, go around from Gabagaba College of Education all the way to Accra College of Education, you will find more abandoned projects than completed projects. Simply because government A comes, starts a 400-bed hostel, and it's abandoned by government B, and then reprocures the same 350 or 400 bed hostel. And then he wouldn't finish, and another one will come. And that I speak, there are about 3 abandoned hostel projects in many of the colleges. Mm. The third one was started last 2 years. And as we sit now, it's still at foundation level.
And a new government may come, which will also abandon it and start a new one. So it becomes a cycle.
I am very, very passionate about the issue of abandoned projects. Mm. So whatever I hear, passionate about it because I know the waste. In the Koforidua Technical University, according to the general report, a project that should have cost Ghana, I think, 8 or 9 million Ghana cedis in 2011, in 2008, was abandoned and completed 4 years ago. And it ended up costing 24 or so million Ghana cedis at Koforidua Polytechnic. So I understand how abandoned projects lead to construction cost overruns and constitute a waste of the taxpayers' money. Mm. So when I hear governments continuing projects started by other governments, it's a plus to the government continuing it. The second one is that we are not just interested in completed projects, as I've said already. If the project is 40% complete, report on it. I'm saying report on it at the point of the launch of the project. It will be captured as one of the new schools built, and it will come to public. It won't go to private. Because NGO schools are normally handed over to government. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, because in collecting that statistic, there is no differentiation between schools constructed by NGOs, schools constructed by donors, and schools constructed by IDAs, by bilateral or multilateral institutions, including loans or IDAs to our World Bank projects. Because that distinction is not made in the MS database, you will find that many schools constructed by NGOs will find their way, all schools constructed by NGOs will find their way onto government's database, because NGOs are building schools, we don't run them, we hand them over to the local governments. So you will see many of that. So we shouldn't be in a haste to count these errors. Mm. But we should take our time. I'm sure similar ones will exist in the health sector too. It won't be different. Mm. And then I explain to the people why some of these are occurring.
But it raises issues about the validation, doesn't it?
Of course, it does. I'm saying that when government is doing anything in an election year, you understand what it means.
Yes.
The main purpose for this is to get votes.
Very well.
That's the main purpose. Mm. Because I've been done every year. Mm. We are in an election year. Government wants to let people know how they are spending their money so that they can get votes. Mm. And that's the main purpose. And so if government is minded to release all such information,
it should do so way before election.
So that we are convinced that it's not because of votes. But so far as I'm concerned, the true trackers I've seen were all launched in election years.
Very well. Let me go to Imani, Amprofu Ajikum. Hello, Amprofu. Welcome to the program. I know Imani has been following. It's actually a good thing we have said, at least around the table. That's one thing we all agree, at least for now, or superficially, that it is good to have a tracker. But my guests have had varying views on how and when the tracker should be launched or made available to the public. What's your own thinking around this?
Okay, thank you, Salom, and hello to your viewers and your listeners as well. So I just sat here just trying to see the middle ground in all of this. Here you have one party saying that because we have put in place a performance tracker, which is accessible to everybody, then in a sense, we are being accountable. Then you have another party saying that, well, this is fictitious. And somehow the count of 67 entries which have been made, which have been found out to have been mistakenly included in the list of projects, because there has been that count, there's a likelihood that everything is fictitious. Now, I want to probably just position my words in the middle ground. Now, just the mere fact, and I'll probably just follow up from what Kofi mentioned. Accountability itself, it doesn't really start, or, you know, we can't really say that, well, we're showing accountability because we've shown what we've been able to do with your money. When you look at some of the projects that they've listed, right, it needs more information. Now, the data is simply missing. I would assume that this is like a project in itself, I mean, a performance tracker. this is a project which is continually going to be improved as we go along. So the impression should not be created that just because we've put in place a performance tracker, then everything is okay. That in itself is wrong. But it's a very good attempt by the government. We do commend the government. What they need to do is to broaden this whole concept of accountability. Now, at the very core of most of our challenges is how policies and projects are formulated. Are they formulated purely based on manifestos? Did the manifestos really reflect what people living in the districts and everywhere that these projects are formed or established? Do they reflect their opinions in the first place? Participatory budgeting, I think Kofi mentioned that. This is very, very, very important. Because if people have some kind of inclusion, if they feel included in the process, then there won't be any arguments for, well, this is very reliable, this is very accurate. We wouldn't also have arguments saying that, well, just to discourage misinformation and disinformation. I think at the very core rationale of this performance tracker is to improve accountability in a way that it opens itself up for people to actually know what is going on. And we've mentioned, single source procurement and competitive bidding and all that. If people feel included in it, then they would have some feel that these projects have been substantiated. Now, let me just touch on the validation exercise that was taken in a build-up towards the performance track. The government indicates that all these were validated from between, I think, January 2017 and to 2023. Now, who were part of the validation process? Were CSOs involved? Were there any third-party contracts given to people who really know what they are doing in terms of monitoring evaluation? Because it helps the government itself. The government now can be able to say, well, we didn't really source these things from our structures, internal structures, but then we had other third parties helping us do that. So then to the public, it will feel as though, yes, this is really something that was really well thought out and conceived. I would forgive the errors, the 67. I may not probably forgive the errors if the errors, the counts are like 4,000, or if the percentage of that is, rises. But at the core of these things, we need to also ask ourselves, how does the performance tracker actually impact on the economy? I mean, is it safe to say that, well, okay, so the government itself has faced challenges along the line. And this is a government which is also trying to report some of the successes that it has chalked over time, right? If these successes have been worthwhile, why is it that it's not making any positive impact on the economy? And that's the question we should really address. We shouldn't be quick to say that, well, because it's an election year, we can just present anything to the Ghanaian public and show that we've done something. Mm. When you look at projects, my last point is that, for example, when you take education, when you take the investments that we made into the education sector, and then you look at even the learning outcomes and the data behind that, these are not things that are in tandem. So let's just separate the argument. Are these things really reflective of the economy, the general economy itself, or is it just a tool that people can have visibility on what government is doing? Mm-hmm.
I see. All right, great, great, great. So that was Amprofi Ajikum, Senior Research Associate of Imani. This is The Big Issue. We are live on 97.3 City FM. My guest, Asilu Kukru, Deputy National Communication Director of the NPP, Edem Agbana, soon to be Honorable, former Deputy National Youth Organizer of the NDC, and also member, parliamentary candidate for Ketu North, Kofi Asare, Executive Director, Africa Education Watch. These are my guests looking at this aspect of the discussion on the government performance tracker that was launched earlier in the week. We're asking whether it's a case of accountability or public political gimmick. Indeed, one of my guests has made a comment that is worried that these trackers only come in election years. We'll interrogate that when we come back from this break. My name is Selom Adonu. This is The Big Issue. We'll be right back. You're welcome back to The Big Issue. We're discussing two key issues: government launch of the performance tracker and the matters that have come out of that. And we're asking whether it's a case of accountability or public political gimmick. Also, we'll look at the matter of the cocoa producer price and the matters surrounding issues of cocoa in Ghana. Cocoa has been the mainstay for a long time, but it does appear that sector is performing quite poorly. In over a decade, the production has been at its lowest, just around 600,000 tons, when we used to do a million tons. And many factors have affected this. There's the swelling shoots and all of that, and galamsey also dealing it a very deadly blow. We'll look at all of that and what the two key political actors, NDC and MPP, have been saying about that. The cocoa board itself, part of government, things that they are doing well. What they are giving the farmers is great. The NDC is saying that they are shortchanging them. We'll look at all of that in the space. And I know Kofi Asare has some thoughts on some other issues, including the scholarship secretariat we want to deal with as well. So this is the discussion. My guests, Asiedu Kokro, Deputy National Communication Director of the MPP, Edem Agbana, parliamentary candidate for Ketu North and former Deputy National Youth Organizer of the NDC, and Profia Jekum, Senior Research Associate with Imani Africa, and of course, Kofi Asare, Executive Director, Africa Education Watch. Looking at the tracker, we've just gone around to look at the essence or the importance of it. I think generally, around the table, my guests agree that it's an important tool that will deepen governance, etc. But there have been various points of departure. The first one having to do with the kind of projects that were put in the central government or local government. That has been discussed. I'm sure we'll delve into that again. Issues of the timing of the release of the tracker, whether it's a vote-catching tool or it's a tool really meant to deepen accountability, transparency, and democracy, and all of that. So, Asiedu Kokro, of course, you've had a discussion from your colleagues. Will you say that given the timing of this and what we saw of the delivery tracker in 2020, the MPP does this because of elections? Remember that we don't need a leader who will think about the next election, but a leader who will think about the next generation. That was the mantra of Nanado when he was coming. Yeah, but it does appear that this tool has been timed for political advantage in an election year.
Oh, not because of political expediency. Because if you look through, you do a audit of the performance tracker, what we have done within the last 7 years, 4 months, we have invested long term, some of the dividend, maybe 10 years, 15 years that we'll be seeing it. So we are not launching this because of elections. Mm. We need to deepen our democracy. Mm. I've said it on many platforms that we are moving. We need to deepen this democracy of ours. But you see, if you look at the...
But the point about the delivery tracker was in 2020, election year.
Yeah.
8 months to election. This has also come. What happened between the
two? It can be coincident, but
we don't have coincidence twice.
What I'm saying is that the bottom line is we need to account. And indeed...
And should the accounting be done at the
end? Indeed, no. There's a confounding variable. We are going to elections. Mm. 8 years, we are forming 8 years in December. We need to account to the Ghanaian people.
Mm. But shouldn't accountability be
It's there. Let me walk you through.
Progressive.
It's progressive.
It should be the way, for example, if I live at Abenta, do I have to wait to the end of your regime to know what you are doing in my area?
Yeah, Salom, it's there. Do you know why? All the ministries, our 30 ministries, and then the disassemblies, we have created government platforms, GA.gov.
But how many people know that?
Many Ghanaians are aware. Mm. That if you want to access it, Mr. Asare was talking about the Minister of Education, MS Management System Platform, where updates are there. Go to Minister of Digitization, go to Minister of Environment and Science, Minister of Rules. Everything is there. Today, when I was going through the Minister of Rules database, that has chanced on, before even the tracker actually captured it, about 16 billion. Mm. Yeah, I've been invested on rules. You see, I want to look at the direction of the NDC, the methodology, and then he was talking about, he said, Selom said, the thing is good, but then Abana, Adam, then he ended saying, a lot is not good. So inconsistency. You see, in statistics,
the principle is good.
Yes.
That's what we all agree.
You see, in statistics, he's very intelligent. Mm. In statistics, when you say a lot of content is not true, in statistics, when we are talking about significance, it's about 70%. Mm. But if you take percentage of 67 of the 13,000 plus, it's 0.52%.
But the 67 is what we have seen in two days.
But he's basing upon that to rubbish. And I'm saying that it's not empirical. You understand? You can't say that a lot of the content is not true.
But it's an issue of credibility. The issue of our credibility.
It's true that the errors are there. Mm. But if you want to make a just position, a strong just position, saying that a lot of the content is not true, which I disagree with him.
So your issue is the phrase a lot.
Yes. In statistics, when we say a lot, significant 70% and above. Mm. Meanwhile, if you take 67% of the errors.
67%.
Yeah, 67 of the errors is 0.52%. Mm. You can approximate to 1%, which is not significant.
Mm.
It's negligible.
I see.
Yeah, in terms of statistics.
So would you be surprised if tomorrow we have a new set of errors showing up?
No, we are saying that.
What you're saying changed.
That is why we launched it. The minister was very clear. We told the Ghanaian people that it's a work in progress.
Mm.
So we welcome all suggestions. We are interested in the feedback.
So there's a suggestion that the details there are not perhaps satisfactory. Like Kofi was trying to state, the procurement, cost of the project.
Yeah, I want to tell you today. Yeah, I want to tell you today.
Is it a useful thing to add?
You are a very learned lawyer. It's not wrong that single source procurement is wrong in the Procurement Act.
No, it's not wrong.
Yes. So if you are doing public commentary and then we are talking about single source procurement, is it wrong? If you read the Procurement Act,
it's important to tell you that. Yeah. In
2015, let me proceed.
I'll give you time to respond. In 2015, 2016, when the president and the vice were running to be president, the issue of corruption and procurement was key. And he says that his government will discourage single source procurement. So if Kofi is raising the issue about single source procurement becoming the norm today, you think it is not an issue that is worth scrutiny?
No, you see, we need to look at the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you are a lawyer, we don't put a conjectured figures into the system. Somebody can say that maybe Minister of Education, he has witnessed three source procurement, then you make a generalization that single source procurement is going on.
You're talking about law. The Procurement Act talks about what should qualify a project to be a single source project.
So I want
if somebody is saying that some of the projects do not meet that threshold.
He's having an NGO that is doing education advocacy in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to publish in the educational sector contracts that have been awarded by the Minister of Education that was single source.
Mm.
And then looking at the exigencies of that time.
Mm.
It's important that when we talk about this thing, we provide data.
Mm.
Yeah, you saw, not because of political expediency.
So that's fine. So is it a good thing to include, as he's suggesting, the type of procurement, the cost of that project?
It has been done.
The type of procurement in this particular tracker?
No, it's not in the tracker.
No, I mean in the tracker.
If you go so that's
a one-stop shop.
Now, if you go to the source of the information, the ministry, that awarded...
Why don't you just put that there? So that is a one-stop shop.
Oh, fine. It's a new suggestion. We'll take that.
To improve the experience.
So that we need to disclose the procurement process there. It's good. So just we'll take it and then we'll... Now, back to the young man who wants to go to parliament. He's saying that projects are little.
Mm.
I know Katie not very well.
Mm.
There are many communities, they don't have toilet. They complain.
Mm.
So if today he gets the opportunity to go and construct toilet there, will he say it's little? You see, what we do in this assessment, government, you see, he's very intelligent, but he missed the point today. You see,
I don't know whether I'm patronizing him or not, but...
I can't patronize him. I'm shocked that he's saying that local government, they have done needs assessment, the disassembly, they go to communities, they do needs assessment.
Mm.
People say they need borehole. The government, through the disassembly, they go and deal borehole, and it is captured. You say it's little.
No, his point is that he expected that this will have headline projects.
No. Yes. That is his definition. And indeed, that is why he make an open preamble saying that what constitutes central government project. And I was amazed. Somebody want to go to parliament and you are questioning this?
No,
I'm amazed.
But
I want to tell Edem today that in government, no project is little.
Mm.
Because a small community that you think that you are going to construct maybe a church compound, they need toilet, a public toilet.
Mm.
That is what is dear to their heart. So all projects that have been done by the government and local governments, needs assessment have been done and it has been provided. And indeed, we have done expanded work and I expected Edem to applaud us because they did not do that. We have done a detailed work that bringing on board the work through government, project that government has facilitated,
and then projects that local government has done. Indeed, let us not rubbish this because of political experience. He says that we are bragging about the numbers. Indeed, the numbers, we have accomplished it. We have achieved it. And I want to say on this your network that we are going to elections, I will be meeting him. If you do profile analysis, health sector, education sector, road sector, every sector, we have been able to pass the NDC. I'm telling you, yes, we have done so well. So indeed, when you do this, they will come, say they will see some few errors, and then they will want to rubbish the whole chain. It's a game changer. So, Selo, let us.
What's the issue about abandoned projects?
It's an issue.
Have we seen progression from there?
Yeah, you see, I read a report when they started talking about the E projects, and then some of the disassembly projects. Some of them, when we formed government, we decided to do forensic audit of some of the projects. Indeed, some of them, Selo, you can't see the contractual agreements. You understand? And it taxpayers' money. If you are not seeing contractual agreements, the ministry has signed a contract of S party, then we can use state money to pay. Remember, Cocoa Board did some forensic audit on Cocoa Rose. And remember, some people, they just ask them to go to site to start work without contractual agreements and others. So many of the contracts that have been abandoned, the projects, some of them, the contractual document to stand on to be able to sanction payment, you can't get it. And nobody wants to cause financial loss to the state. Yes. So some of them, the reports are there that some of the ministries, some of the projects, you can't let the contractor to go unless maybe it's re-awarded because you can't get contractual documents to be able to show that indeed that contract went through the procurement process and then the person was awarded the contract to execute the project. So these are the things that we have not averted our minds to. So it's not deliberate that government can come and then they say that, oh, this project, we have neglected the project. Sometimes, some of them, because of politics, they can tell you, go to side, we'll regularize it for you. But change of government will come, and then the regularization process is truncated because it's a new regime and they want to do a forensic audit, look at what is at stake. So if the documents are not so clean, nobody wants to cause financial loss to the state. Yeah, it's important we look at that. So it's a good thing that we are talking about. There are many projects that we have been able to complete. That's why the NDC government started, and then we have been able to complete.
So when some of them, the things you've put in the tracker, how does it compare with the promises you made?
We have done. Indeed, this is what I told one journalist when we launched the project on Wednesday at Chimpa, that when you take our manifesto, the things we told the Ghanaian people, we have gone beyond. We have gone beyond. More than 95% of what in our manifesto, we have accomplished. And we are doing things that we did not capture it in our manifesto. It's unprecedented. I'm telling you, sir.
But every government does things. It doesn't
no, but we have done great,
the
great
meat issues. You see, when they come
my friend is here, and he has written a lot about the free secondary school. The innovations and initiatives that we have brought into the Ghana education sector is unprecedented. I'm telling you, we have done great things that many people in the educational sector are amazed that how we were able to get money to be able to accomplish. They are amazed. I'm telling you.
I see,
look at the investments in the educational sector. So I saw a reportage from Africa Education World. They did analysis of the investments. But look at the data.
Some of the things they've said were not really complimentary to you.
For me, I've said that Africa Education World have not challenged that from 2017 to now. The last time I checked the data by the president, when the president did the president, October 2023, we have invested close to about 115 billion Ghana cedis in education. Free senior high school is close to about 13 billion and the rest. We have not seen anybody disputing these figures.
No, but the figures could be correct or not, but it's the output or the impact, the outcome. What happens, the impact is supposed to be.
It's only in Ghana. People think that, you know, we are not looking at assets, we are looking at assets and quality. Elsewhere, when assets is increasing, you begin to see diminishing returns in the quality. But for us, the figures is good. And my friend is here. The figures are good. I'm taking the statistics, the scores of the students. It's not bad. It has been increasing.
Very well.
And it's good.
Very
and it is why many educational experts are shocked that we are increasing enrollment.
And quality is still good.
And quality is good.
There can be few
outlier observation.
Yeah, I like that we cannot. Well, only made a general point. You make a point about outliers.
There can be some few outliers that can occur. But great. Basically and by and large, we are done great. Right. Instead of, I want to use this platform to encourage Ghanaians to go to the platform, the performance tracker.
Mm-hmm.
You should go and look at what we have done for the Ghanaian people. Every Ghanaian, especially civil society organizations, and then actors, the political actors, like my young man who says little project. In politics, we don't have little projects.
Is there little projects?
It's good. Community, they are saying they need toilet, and you want to be a member of parliament. So if you build toilet in the near future, it's a little project.
So Kokoro, it's okay.
I quoted you, it's here.
So that's fine. So Adam, I mean, your comment about central government projects versus local government projects doesn't seem to be sitting well with many of the people. Government is government, and whether central government or local government, it is the people's money used for those projects. And what the performance track or the MPP is saying is that once it's your money, we are accounting to you. So no matter where it is, it's maybe in a hamlet or in a village somewhere, we still have to account to the people. That's how come they say we have boreholes and toilets and all of that in the performance tracker.
Salom, let me first correct the mischievous attempt by my senior brother to create the impression that we are belittling this, all these solutions, boreholes and all of that. No, that's not what I said. And I think it's important for us to elevate the conversation to that level, respectfully. I made mention of the fact that because this was a central government accountability platform, I was expecting the government to focus more on the headliners, on the headline project.
I
used the word central government.
I said
I expected the central government to give an account of their projects that they initiated, projects they funded from the central government coffers. And I pointed out to you that is what we did in the Green Book. That if this Green Book, the NDC had decided to include in the Green Book projects undertaken by the various district assemblies, the NDC could have as well recorded no less than 40,000 projects. And I tell you that on record. Because even as we speak, with the figures you have provided, I'm happy Kofi is here, when we cross-check from the MIS data, the NDC built more schools, the NDC even employed more teachers than your government. In terms of health facilities, you can't. The MIS data is there. I can make reference to the MIS data. You don't just dismiss it as it's not true. Where is the source? I am quoting, I'm referencing the Education Management Information Systems data. I mean, I believe that's the full meaning of MIS. And so I'm referencing that the MIS data, which is updated daily by the Ministry of Education, provides the fact as to the number of educational projects undertaken by both governments, and the NDC is far ahead when it comes to those projects. And so don't belittle or don't try to be so mischievous by creating the impression that the provision of boreholes and all of those things are not important. We are doing, but I said that as central government, you are expected to report on central government projects. Then let the district assemblies also provide an account of what they have been doing over the last 7 years. Again, when you go to the tracker says, as part of its preamble, that you are delivering on your promises. Now, what do we remember as the promises of the NPP in 2016? You promised one village, one dam. Why is the tracker silent on it? How many dams have you provided? These are the questions that we ought to be answering. Number two, you promised each constituency $1 million every year. It's been 7 years. Tell me one single constituency that has received the 1 million per constituency every single year for development projects. Tell me, my constituency hasn't received it. Our listeners, our viewers, they should tell us which constituency has received it. You have invested over $100 million into the most expensive hole that you call National Cathedral. Why is the tracker silent on that? What is the update on that project? What is the percentage of completion? Can we find that in the tracker? You told us about building 350 senior high schools. These were the promises that the people of Ghana remember. So when you have failed, you've performed abysmally for 7 years. Then in an election year, 8, 9, 10 months to election,
you decide to launch a tracker and include all the projects from the district assemblies, projects that when you compare to what the NDC has done, is nothing but mediocre projects. We are free to tell you that your government has underperformed, your government has been very abysmal, and your government has failed. Again, in December 2015, few days after the NDC launched the Green Book, Dr. Bawumia at the NPP Extraordinary Conference said or mentioned that the NDC government had received about 200 billion and that what we had said or we had included in the Green Book had nothing, but he described them as projects that are not worth that amount. And he challenged the government to provide the cost for each project. Here we are today. We are asking for the cost of the projects that you have undertaken. And you are challenging that it is not whatever. Dr. Bawumia said in 2015 that government ought to publish the cost of each of the projects that we had listed in the Green Book. Meanwhile, when you go to the Green Book, most of the projects stated, for example, the E-blocks, and all the hospital projects, the market projects, all listed in this Green Book, we attach a cost to it. And so it even answered the question even before it was asked. But you have failed to provide a single cost for all of these things. And at the end of the day, you want to be mischievous. Again, in my earlier submission, I gave you the Green Book and I said, today is a very good opportunity for you as an MPP communicator. Because the MPP has created impressions all over that this Green Book contains projects that are not there in reality. So I've given you a free copy of the book. We've had breaks. As I'm speaking, Kofi will speak. You have all the time to point out a single project in this Green Book that is not in reality. You will not be able to do that.
It's not true.
But we have been able to point out projects that you have listed on your performance tracker in less than 48 hours. And I'm saying that let's not assume that the 67 projects listed are the only projects that are not the accurate representation of what they actually posted. Because those 67 are the ones that we exposed on social media. There are many of the other projects that people are not taking their time to cross-check. For example, I have given you several examples, and I've asked a very important question. Now, when you talk about cassava factory, and you write it is 100% complete, and that is what you have reported in on your performance tracker, and yet the factory is not being used or is not in operation, how do you describe that? So you build a white elephant. You invest taxpayers' money into building a structure that has become a white elephant, and yet you list that as an achievement. What is a factory when it is not in operation? What is a factory when it has not employed a single soul? What is a factory when it has become a playground for rodents? So at the end of the day, the mediocrity of this government is so glaring that the performance tracker has only amplified the failure of this government. And so don't be mischievous about it. Let's get into the real issues. Again, Selom, the issue about it being released in election year and all of that. 4 years ago, government released what they call the performance or delivery tracker. 4 years ago. Today, you go on that website and it is not there, nothing is there. Because they have to pull it down and they have created something new. That is what they have done. Now, if governance is about continuing on projects that you've even inherited or you started in your first term and all of that, they could as well have built on the delivery tracker if it was anything factual. Now, I'm calling on the citizens, and people must go to the site and check, because many of the, let me say, citizen journalists, people who have taken time to go through the sites, are the ones reporting that many of the projects that they have stated are not projects, or they are not actually in existence. Some they have written 100% completed. Those projects have not been completed. The government is so desperate to the extent that they are even stealing projects initiated by NGOs, and they are listing those ones as their projects. Projects initiated by NGOs. You include all of that and you are bragging about a certain 13,000 projects. And that's why I'm saying that the central government is only dabbling in mediocrity. Now, let me tell you what a performance tracker of this government should be looking like. The performance tracker should be able to tell us what happened to the 350 senior high schools that they promised to build. A performance tracker should be able to tell us that the one district, one factory project that they promised, where in 2016, they released a list of all the constituencies. There was a chart where each constituency and the project that they expected or they were promising to build. I have all of that here. That whole chart was released for each and every district. The question is that, go back to the chart and tell me how many of the projects listed in that promise have been delivered. Because if you are telling me that your performance tracker is to give an account that you are delivering on your promises, why are you being evasive? That the things you promise, you're running away from them.
No, but they promised one D1F.
Yes.
They may not have done so in all the districts, but they've done so in some districts.
When you read the promise, and I have here the manifestos of the NPP.
Mm.
When you read the promise that was made, they told us that they had conducted an assessment of each and every district based on economic activities. And that is how they identified which factory best suits whichever district. Mm-hmm. And so they included that in a chart. Now, when they came into office, what they have done is that this so-called one district, one factory project that they wanted the central government to lead, they have run away from me. What they are doing is that when they give support to even existing factories, they give you some amount of money or some support in any form. Then they list that as a one district, one factory project, which is laughable because.
But if it's expansion, and it's to do since, the same thing a fresh factory would
since,
do.
Since 1957, every government in our history has provided what we call stimulus package. Under the NDC government, the pharmaceutical industry received huge financial investment from the NDC as stimulus package. But President Mahama cannot claim that he is the one that introduced Kina Pharma or whichever pharmaceutical company because they benefited from his stimulus package. So we have to be sincere with the people.
No, but you it's packaging. It's how you package it, right?
No, you see, it is not. Let's not allow. No,
there's a government.
Let's not allow government to be deceptive.
1D1F to support industrialization.
So you want to support industrialization? You promised and listed each district and which factory you wanted to build for them. In your failure to do that, you go and provide a stimulus package, which every government in our history has done. Then you claim that even factories that have been in existence from 57, some from 1940s, you now claim and you list all of that as your achievement.
No, I think it's in context.
It is not in context.
It's in terms of the expansion, isn't it?
Let's not allow government to use semantics to play on the minds of the people of Ghana. Now, this is it. CTFM has been all, CTFM, CCTV has been operating for a while. If in 2025, President Mahama decides that he's giving stimulus package to the media, and he gives you, say, 1 million Ghana cedis as support, he cannot claim that. He can say that he has given stimulus package for expansion of CCTV. But he cannot claim
but he can list
to be
CCTV.
The originator.
No, not the originator.
You see,
is it the devil is
what
in the
was
detail?
Promised? The devil is in the detail.
So, this government,
because they are so deceptive in nature, they have been trying to play with words, deceiving and all of them. I asked, what was the promise? You should be able to tell us.
Very well.
And what have you been delivering?
Very well.
You should be able to tell us. So at the end of the day, this delivery tracker or whatever has only come to amplify the government's mediocrity, has come to amplify the government's failure. But there are key questions to ask, and we are asking them. Look, if you are telling me that the essence of introducing the performance tracker is to give an account of how you spent my taxpayers' money, don't tell me how you spent 30,000 to drill a borehole for my community without telling me how you have wasted $100 million digging a hole in the name of a cathedral. Don't tell me that you have spent 40,000, okay, to provide or to refurbish a school in my community without telling me or without accounting for the hundreds of millions that we lost to the PDS scandal. When you are telling me that you are embarking on rural electrification, or you are spending 100,000 in our community to provide light, which is essential, you cannot use that to evade the question of how so much money has been lost to corruption Very because well. You have failed to account for those ones.
Great.
Let the performance tracker go into the details of what you have promised.
So your view is that the performance tracker is just positive. It doesn't talk about the other side of it.
No, my view is not that it is positive.
What I mean is, my view is that if you
claim that you are accounting for the money that you have collected,
so they should talk about the other side too.
Tell me how you use my over $100 million to dig that useless, expensive hole in the name of national capital.
Because I was expecting to also see the national capital in there. At least tell us that it is 10% complete, 2% complete, or something.
It's actually a negative percentage.
One of your achievements, quote unquote, because the place has been cleared, something is going on, something is happening at least. So be preparing for that. Kofi, so now we zoom into the education sector in your case, because you've done quite a lot of that in the sector, especially in the primary or basic school arena. I don't know whether you've taken time to look at the tracker in respect of the schools. They say that 96%, there's been a 96% increase in the number of trained teachers in the 2020-2021 academic year. They say over 4.7 million pupils have been enrolled in school in the 2020-2021 academic year. 1.8 million kids enrolled in KG in the 2020-2021 academic year. The teacher to pupil ratio, which is quite interesting for me, is 1 to 31. One to 31. But we've seen classes where the students are about 80, 85, even in Accra. You know, and there's one teacher or something, there are two teachers. So I don't know, you clarify that for me. And quite a number of things they have said. Kindergarten, 1:31, and a whole lot, trained teachers. I mean, quite a number of things. And the big one also is the free SHS, how government has implemented the free SHS, and how that has lessened the burden on parents. But I also know that you recently did some work in respect of how parents still bear costs despite a free, you know, SHS. According to your report, about 77% of the cost is still borne by parents, and that was quite huge. So put all of these things together for me and tell me what you make of the government's achievements so far vis-a-vis what they put in the tracker in respect of the education sector.
Before I go to that, let me just indicate that, yes, if you are tracking performance, you should actually have the baseline. You should have the promise first. What was the promise? And then you track the implementation of that promise. It appears that in the tracker, we are being told deliverables without corresponding promises. And so it is not what I would call a proper evaluation. You must have the promise.
Or the baseline?
No. You must have the promise first.
Okay.
That is, the promise should be the outcome. I mean, not the outcome, but the promise should be the anticipated end line. So you must have the promise, have the baseline as of 2017, and then you have the end line data. Then we are able to properly measure the performance. And within this context, at EduWatch, we launched what we call an education promise tracker. We started the activity, I think, 3 years ago. And by February 2023, we had identified 226 education sector promises, which we are tracking. We are tracking the implementation of all these promises between 2017 and we are waiting till June, because we don't want to lose 3 quarters in the last year. It is very, very significant. So end of June, we will complete the measurement of 226 education promises, which we identified from the promise source, baseline, and then end line. And hopefully we should launch it by the end of June to have a much more structured basis to compare. And of course, discuss the key accomplishments of the government in the period. Now, to the accomplishments espoused in the education section of the government's tracker. At a basic level, yes, we have seen the regular increase in enrollment that we see every year. Obviously, we see 2 to 3% increase in enrollment, consistent population growth, and then age cohort population growth, and all that. And so, government reporting on enrollment at the basic level is in order. But at a basic level, the issues that, and if you compare it to the baseline, the issues we came to meet, and if I say we came, I'm talking about the government came to inherit from the NDC government, wasn't necessarily about declining enrollment at basic schools. It was about high dropout rates. 35% of students who start kindergarten one do not complete junior high school three in Ghana. That is what the tracer data says, data from the Ministry of Education. That is the problem with retention that the government came to meet. As we speak, the data available for the Ministry of Education suggests that about 35% of students who start in kindergarten one are still dropping out before junior high school three. Last year, those who were the BEC, the 600,000 students, when they were starting, you know, the number was about 800,000. By the time they completed, writing BEC, that reduced to 600,000. So the fundamental issue of high level of dropout, which is highest in the five northern regions and in OT, hasn't been addressed at all. Indeed, in regions like the Northeast region and Savannah, you have only 3 out of 10 who enroll in KG1 moving to secondary.
3 out of 10?
Yes. In the northern region, the traditional northern region, only 5.5 out of 10 who enroll in KG1 complete primary 6.
And did you dig to find out what the cost, possible costs?
Of course, the costs are, they are traditional. No new cost. The first is the distance committed to school.
Okay.
Because in these communities, you have the lowest number of primary schools and the lowest number of junior high schools. And so pupils, after completing primary school, with 4.5 dropping out by primary 6, have to trek further by 10 or so kilometers to a community with junior high school. Distance to school is the first major cause of dropout in the northern regions and OT.
Which calls for the building of school facilities?
Which calls for two things.
Yes.
The building of, the convention is that, and I didn't say policy, the convention is that students shouldn't walk more than 3 kilometers to school at the primary level. So within every 3 kilometers, there must be a primary school reasonably accessible by foot, on foot, you know, by pupils. But in this part of the country, you realize that due to the sparsely located nature of the communities, it becomes difficult for you to have schools within 3 to 5 kilometers, even the primary school. So students trek. Distance affects them. Poverty also exists. But when they manage, when the 5.5 out of 10 who start KG1 manage to complete primary 6, they have to trek further to another community because only 50% averagely of the primary schools in these 6 regions
have
GSS. Okay. So you are trekking further. And by the time you start GSS1, the number drops. So only 3 out of 10 who start kindergarten 1 will likely cross junior high school 3 and enter senior high school.
Let me state that in the tracker, we see that 526 basic school projects were completed nationwide from 2017 to 2023. So I'm sure the completion of this over 500 projects would have worked to reduce the problem in a way. I'm sure the problem would have been more exacerbated if we didn't have this intervention of 526 basic schools. I mean, that's just to add to what you were saying, Kofi.
Yes, it is the case. But again, if you look at the whole country, 536 or so
26, yeah.
basic schools in 7 years, the meaning is that each assembly, each district is getting an average of 2.2 schools a year. Do you know what that means? It means that in the whole of Chifuhimai or the whole of Tatale Sanguli,
just two,
in a year, just 0.2, not two.
Okay,
point two. It means that in 5 years, statistically, they saw only one basic school. That's a problem. That's a huge problem. It means that we are nowhere near solving the problem, because if the rate at which we are building schools is a rate of 0.2 per district per year, just divide the number you mentioned by 7 and by 260, we are nowhere.
No, but that analysis depends upon existing schools. So, for instance, if my learned friend, some districts may have the most schools than, you know, your studies you did about the Northern Ghana, they were not having more schools there. So, if maybe you do the audit, if you look at the generalized average that you are picking, it may not be.
In fact, the trend, in this, if you enter this 538, the trend actually favors urban school, urban areas. Majority of these schools you have mentioned were built by local governments. And when you I talk about local government, I talk about local government's capacity to raise adequate IGF to build their own schools. And this local government will not include Tata Lesamuli. It will not include Nanumba South.
Because they cannot raise the
IGF. It will not include Nkwanta South. No. Because they don't have capacity to raise IGFs below more than 5 million. Like Adenta that is doing about between about 15 million, Tema doing about 20. Adenta is building Adenta Community School, which was under three for 3 years. They are building it. They have the capacity. But you don't expect that capacity in Savilogu. You understand? And so these schools here are skewed in favor of urban municipalities because majority of them were built by local governments.
And the problem really is in the rural areas.
If I track the national budget and I look at the amount of allocations to education, basic education infrastructure in the 5 years, I can tell you that about 70% of these schools were built by local government. So local governments with capacity to raise IGFs and construct these schools are normally the peri-urbans and then the urbans. So I'm saying that the fundamental issue of dropout, okay, and the cause being the limited number of public basic schools, is not being adequately addressed. The rate is low, and I understand why the rate is low. Because within this period, we are doing over 800 senior high school projects. And so it's the same CAPEX budget you're going to use to build new schools at the basic level that you are using to build the 800 plus projects in the senior high schools. Expanding senior high schools to accommodate the increasing numbers of the free senior high school. But you are doing from 800,000 to about 2.5 million people have benefited so far. So you are expanding facilities. At the same time, you cannot accord the same level of priority to basic. That is why we kept saying that basic is suffering. Basic is suffering. Basic has really suffered by way of this. So enrollment is increasing at basic level, yes, because every year you will see 2.5 to 3% increase in enrollment anyways. But retention, when we are measuring assess outcomes at basic level, we look at retention and completion. And transition, primary 6 to junior school and transition. By 2021, 2022, we're doing at the national level 93%, which means 7% of people were dropping out. We're not moving to junior school 3. But in these deprived regions, 18%, we're doing 82. 18% of people were not crossing from primary 6 to junior school 1. And these are traditional flaws in our education system that have existed for decades. And so I would have expected that the focus would be on in blocking these loopholes and ensuring that we improve the retention rate in our basic education system.
I see. So let me speak to Amprofo Ajiman, who is with Imani Senior Research Associate. So I mean, in putting all of this together, it does appear that the figures are there. But when you drill down to the figures, the impact may not be as fantastic as the figures may look on the screen or on the website. So what should we be dealing with? How should we be looking at this? Because the figures have been given to us, like Kofi is saying, we don't know the promise, we don't even know the baseline. We've just been given what has been done. What then becomes the basis for us to measure this so we can give a proper score to it? Because, for example, you say maybe 526 schools have been built. Against what? We do not have that. How should we be looking at this?
Well, thank you, Salom. I think Kofi is right on all the points that he raised. In fact, in-house in Imani, we've actually stopped counting manifesto promises as we used to do a few years ago. Now, what we seek to do is to actually ask political parties how much would they require to actually fund each project, just so we can have an idea of what they are doing. Else, you know, you keep having promises after promises and they are not going to be fulfilled. Now, to your question, I think that somehow the government is probably admitting that much more needs to go into the tracker. There has to be a lot more information that has to be provided. Now, when you rank it in percentage, as has been discussed, What is the basis of that? Do projects that have been completed but not occupied or not operational, are they considered 100% complete? What are the yardsticks? And again, like Kofi said, the promises has to match whatever the deliverables in the tracker is showing us. One, the tracker needs much more information. It needs real data. It has to, if the justification is that, well, projects that are done at the central level should also include, I mean, all the projects should include central level projects, not of course district level projects. Then it goes also to prove that you also have to have a very holistic approach to this. Give us all the data that CSOs and the media can validate for themselves. And I think moving forward, one of the things they could do is actually involve an independent body or entity so that the validation exercise is really worthwhile. You cannot just come and set up a good website, which I think is a very commendable initiative, and just expect that people will not be asking questions. I believe that when people begin to verify these things more intensely, we could see a few flaws here and there. As to whether these are intentional or not, we just leave it to the political parties to battle it out. But because we've spent money doing this, we need to be able to improve it. And the only way to improve it is to provide all the needed information. It seems pretty vague, to be frank. It's a good initiative. It seems vague. We need more information to make it more holistic. Mm.
Very well. So that's a tracker discussion. I want to move on to the next thing. But before I do so, of course, earlier in the week, we saw a press statement from EduWatch. And because Kofi is here, so I want him to address that quickly. In respect of the scholarship matter that became topical in the past week and some part of this week. And incidentally, the tracker also has a portion of scholarships. So it says that provision of educational grant to Zongo Needy, 404 educational support provided to selected needy Zongo tertiary students, 404. 360% increase compared to 2012-2016 year in terms of local scholarships. That's about 124,000 students awarded with local scholarship for the time frame, within the time frames. Foreign scholarship, which where I think the issue really is, 158% increase compared to 2012-2016. 7,423 students awarded with foreign scholarships from 2017 to 2021. So, EduWatch, earlier in the week, I'm sure in response to some of the expose we saw from the Fourth Estate, actually called for what it calls a public scholarships law to establish a commission, that should make the provision of scholarship, to beneficiaries a bit more transparent in terms of the selection process, etc. So, Kofi, once you're here, I mean, I think it's useful to have a bite on this, and I'm sure my panelists will have a few minutes each on that.
Yeah, I think it's great that the government is reporting on how it has used our tax CD for scholarships. We haven't seen that in the past. Perhaps we thought that it was too small, or whatever the reason may have been, but it is good to see the outcomes of the management of scholarships being reported in the tracker. But as I said, citizens are not only interested in being informed about projects or deliverables when they are done. They are also interested in knowing how those deliverables were arrived at, and the value for money case in arriving at those deliverables, as I indicated initially. The same equation fits into this. How were these scholarships procured? How did the way we procured these scholarships assure value for money and prudent use of economic resources? Because this is a case where we have a scholarship system that is designed as a reward mechanism for the political elites, students who are student leaders who conform to, who behave well in terms of, their behavior to the executive, and then children of politicians and all that. And this has been there for long. I must admit, it didn't start under this regime. It's been there for long. We know whatever has been taking place at the scholarship secretariat, from the allegations of people selling scholarships to the cronies and nepotism, that's been there.
But citizens are interested in knowing beyond the number of beneficiaries, how were they procured? And that is why I find the interest in the work of the Fourth Estate, the interest by citizens to be very, very, very progressive. We must push for reforms in our scholarship system. I'm going straight to what we should do, because everybody knows the mess that we are in already. I don't need to repeat that. And I'm not saying we should do what other countries are doing, but my understanding of how public scholarships work in the many countries that I have worked in tells me that, one, having an amorphous public scholarship scheme is not workable in Ghana. It doesn't assure value for money. You can't have GMPC Foundation doing scholarship. You can't have GetFund doing scholarship. Cocoa doing scholarship. This, that. No, these are all publicly owned institutions. And so the first we need to do is that we need to amalgamate. We need to put all the silos of scholarships existing under one umbrella called a scholarships authority. And give that authority the legal backing to be a regulator of scholarships in Ghana. If 60% of your scholarship portfolios you want to invest 60% of your portfolio in STEM, so be it. It will be the guiding principle for distributing scholarships. But let all scholarships come under this authority. Give it a law and make it accountable to Parliament and the Auditor General. That is one. Two, in this law, provide that the scholarships authority implements or disburses or distributes or manages scholarships through the faculties, strictly through the faculties. This authority is a regulatory body. So the faculties are the ones going to do the distribution of scholarships, the means testing, distribution, and the management of the scholarships, and report to the regulator or report to Parliament. And in doing so, they do it with the transparency that we see the university do their work.
The faculties meaning the universities.
The universities.
So if somebody wants a scholarship to study abroad, yeah, how does the faculty come in there?
It's very, very simple. There shouldn't be anything like you want a scholarship to study abroad. It shouldn't even exist. Now, having worked on various government projects till 2018, where skills development was funded, this is the best practice. If I want to go and do a course in UK, and the course doesn't exist in Ghana, what we did on many of these World Bank funded projects was that we will promote faculty-to-faculty collaboration. If the faculty is in India to train you in a particular skill area not available in Ghana, we link up with the training institution in India with a relevant faculty in a training institution in Ghana. And the faculties will collaborate and mount the course, and you'll be trained here. There is best practice in how to do all this. We just don't want to do the right thing.
How about issues about exposure? You know, getting knowledge from elsewhere to come better your society. So there's a thing to be said for studying abroad, because you see bigger and better things, maybe more advanced systems. You go learn, come back to better your own, you know, system.
So you are saying that, okay, so instead of doing an LLB in Ghana, I'll go and do LLB in London and then get exposure there. Is that the case?
Maybe for courses which... For areas which are not, so for example, something like artificial intelligence. Obviously, there are countries which have better exposure to that than us. So instead of doing it in Ghana, maybe you want to go study how others do it, learn from what they have, come back and improve our systems.
One of the best institutions you can learn AI is Ashase and then Academy City. Some of them are in Ghana here. And they've built those institutions with faculty, North-South faculty collaborations. Some of the lecturers there are from the same country you're talking about, and so it doesn't even arise. There are various avenues or strategies of seeking exposure, and not necessarily in the classroom or learning. If you want to go on study visits, you can go on study visits. But that's not a scholarship issue. That's the point I want to make. What I want to say is that if you want to go and train some cardiothoracic surgeons, because we don't have that training facility in Ghana here, it is permissible.
That's a need the nation must identify.
That's why we indicated in our release that where foreign scholarships are necessary, the necessity should be based on the skills anticipation strategy of the country. It should be based on the labor market information system of the Ministry of Employment, where we have a list of labor or skills that are in acute shortage or do not exist in Ghana. So if you fall within that category, that this particular skill set is not available here. Very rare case. That is one. And then two, that the faculties in this country cannot deliver a training. If these two exist, and in the short term, the faculties cannot cooperate and man that program in Ghana, it makes sense to go and train abroad. I'm saying there are many interventions of government where these systems are applied. We just don't wake up and take people to go and learn, to go and do scholarships abroad because they want to go abroad.
Very well.
90% have gone through the list. And let me put on record that Africa Education World has been engaging the Scholar Secretariat since late last year. This report by the Fourth Estate is up to 2021, right?
Yes.
We have requested for 2022 and 2023 scholarships. And it's taking many months. Mm-hmm. And we are still battling them. They are refusing to release the information. Mm-hmm. The RTI Commission is in the middle mediating. We've appealed to the chief of staff and they are still not releasing it. The failure, okay, to move from a system of limited non-disclosure to limited disclosure to limited non-disclosure is for me my problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because the RTI legislation that President Akufo-Addo championed and passed was to transition public institutions from a quarter of limited disclosure to limited non-disclosure. But the Scholarship Secretariat is living in the past where its culture is secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you afraid of light? I hope you are getting me. And so we must transition our institutions in line with the laws that govern us, the RTI law,
mm-hmm.
make them reflect the open governance accolades that the president continues to espouse.
Mm-hmm.
The Scholarship Secretariat, which works under the president, is the opposite of what the president continues to espouse publicly as
well.
Open governance. The final thing we need to do about the scholarship system is that after letting the faculties do the distribution of scholarships, we acknowledge that the Scholarship Secretariat doesn't only give scholarships to students. It also gives scholarships to civil servants who need to upgrade. Okay. And so we want in the law a collaboration between employers in the public sector and the faculties.
Mm.
All skills upgrading that staff require, layer to faculties and mount the courses here and train them here. Is that not why GEMPA and other institutions were established?
Mm.
And so if you hear anyone asking the question, it is difficult to determine someone who is needy, that discussion shouldn't be entertained at all anywhere, including CTFM here. Mm. That discussion about we can't define who is needy. Anyone who says that we have to continue in this culture of politicized scholarships because you can't determine who is needy, it's not ready to change for the better.
Mm.
The only people who cannot define who is needy are the beneficiaries of the system.
Mm.
Other than that, Get Fund, administering scholarships to about 4,000 students a year, did not have challenges in determining who is needy when they were administering local scholarships. So why or how did it suddenly become so difficult to determine who is needy when it comes to foreign scholarships?
Mm.
So it is not one of the challenges. One of our problems is not about who is needy. It is not one of our problems. It is only a smokescreen to maintain the order to continue to please the elite.
Very well.
So let's move towards a system where we have a scholarship system that appeals to the skills anticipation needs of Ghana.
Very well.
And also that appeals to, of course, the needs of needy students who really need support to go and learn, including Ghana. And I'm saying that if we do this, we might end up spending 95% of the funding that goes to the scholarship secretariat on local scholarships.
Mm.
Because the need for scholarship is 99% local and 1% foreign.
Very well. You will wrap it up because you are government more or less. So very briefly on this. Very briefly, yeah.
I have never been as angry and as terrified
angry about scholarship.
Oh, wait, let him make his point. Let him make his point, please. Kokro, you have your time.
Don't say that.
Kokro.
Support the reforms.
No, Kokro. Kokro.
Why are you being so scared?
I'm not scared.
You have not listened to me. What is all of this?
No, don't worry.
Yes, but I think that it is important that
you respect. Let's respect.
No. So you proceed.
Let's respect our views. I'm here to make my submission on the matter. You have already taken a position. Salom, I was so angry and terrified reading the articles by the Fourth Estate about the scholarships. But I'm happy some individuals, including the Deputy National Youth Organizer of the NDC, Lawyer Osman Ayariga, has petitioned the OSP to look into it. And I'm happy the Africa Edu Watch and Co. are getting into the conversation. I was angry because we are gradually, and this is to everyone in the political class, creating a society where if you do not have some connection to people holding political power, basic things like scholarship to build your capacity, even that the state denies you. I am a parliamentary candidate. I, in my own little way, sponsor a lot of students in the various universities or tertiary institutions across this country for my constituency, because they usually write. There are sometimes, some of them even have scholarships from the schools, but even the transport fare from the constituency to campus is a big challenge for them. I'm sure Mr. Asari can testify to some of these things. Then you read that an individual benefits over 600,000, 700,000 worth of scholarships. And for some of them, they do not even report in the schools. Some are even getting it in doubles. And so this year, they are paying £38,000 for you to go to a school to go and do a certificate course. The next year, another amount for one individual. And I am thinking that, look, if we are not careful, as politicians, if we are not careful as a political class, a day will come where the young people of this country will just say that enough is enough, because you can't certainly build a society like this. I'm getting into it. It may not have started today, but where we are today, let's also admit that under this government, we are seeing it being done in the most ridiculous manner. And I'm saying that if we are interested in the investigation, if you are telling me that it didn't start today, it doesn't mean we should accept that it's happening. If you are interested, you are the government of the day. Prosecute or bring out people who may have benefited from this unethical scholarship. That's how I would call it in the past. But this is what we have on the table today. So let's not even shift the conversation to whether it's happening in the past or not. But we must be, and your government must be ashamed that you have somebody like Gifty Owari, an appointee of the government, Deputy Executive Director of the National Service Schemes, receiving huge sums of salary and allowances. And those are the people you are sponsoring to assess education.
She said she never benefited.
No, but that is what the investigation has. She should take them to court or challenge them. I haven't even heard her issue a disclaimer. So you are saying, I'm hearing it for the first time.
She said she had a conversation, but she didn't have it.
And all the names that they have mentioned, some have benefited 738,000 Ghana cedis. You know what that can do? That how much that amount? And look, I believe that this issue, even the way the media, very few stations like yours, have paid attention to this issue, I think that we are not angry enough. The daughter of Freddie Blay, political appointees, people who are benefiting. Look, these issues are not things that we should joke or play politics with, because these are serious issues of even national security. Now ask myself, I am a son of a driver. My father was never a politician. My mother has never had formal education. So, but for the benevolence of some individuals who helped in sponsoring my education, maybe today I wouldn't have been where I am today. Now, how many brilliant but needy, really needy students don't we have? Sometimes people even go to the extent of raising funds for people who made 8 A's, 7 A's on social media in order to put them through education at the tertiary level. You have all of these cases. The scholarship secretariat is investing these huge sums of millions of dollars into individuals who have what it takes to pay their own fees. And it's not as if the courses that they are going to pursue are courses that are so, I don't know how to put it. You had a way of putting it.
Acute shortage.
Let's say we have acute shortage. For example, LLB.
Some are even certificate programs, business administration, courses that project management, political science, courses that our universities here are running. People are assessing 500,000 Ghana cedis to go to schools. And apart from the school fees being paid, they are even giving feeding allowance and all of that. They are rented and with our taxpayers' money. These are serious issues that none of us, and I'll be surprised if you justify it. Because you see, we are gradually dissipating the confidence of the people in governance. You don't do this because it is a sign of weakness and insensitivity. But you see, there's a solution on board, and I want to go into it briefly.
So yes,
he seconds, proposed, or Edwards is proposing, the scholarship authority. And then also trying to bring a law and bringing all the, you see, I agree with them. But I don't think that the problem is legislation. We have enough legislation. The problem is that we do not have leaders with conscience handling this.
Yeah,
so you can have the law.
We don't have any legislation on scholarships.
Yeah, everybody does it the way. But if there's a law,
but you see,
or there's a system, a guideline, which defines
so
who should
there's
qualify.
There's no legislation on scholarships.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that our problem is not the legislation. Our problem is that you have people without conscience.
Yeah, so the legislation will ensure that they do the right thing if they have no conscience.
My proposal, and I've seen it work, I was SRC president at the University of Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
The SRC introduced a scholarship, of which I had the opportunity to be on the scholarship board,
mm-hmm.
and how we interview people for the process. This is my proposal. That like you're saying, if GMPC, Ghana Gas, and all these other state institutions are interested in giving scholarships, all must be put into one fund. I believe that at the district assembly levels, we can constitute a board, a scholarship board at the district assembly. So where, if I'm from Ketunov and I want to access scholarship, I put in my application for the local scholarship. And when I go on the board, maybe my paramount chief, the MCE, reps of some other state institutions, and all of them are there, then I'll have the confidence
to interview and access you.
And all of that. Not, it must not be centralized, because the moment it is centralized, you're still going to have this problem of the people managing it, whether it is backed by law, trying to use it
to advance the political. What they are saying is currently what the scholarship secretary does.
No, they do not do it at the local level.
They do it. They do it. That's why I'm saying that. They do it. They do it.
But I think the problem really is with the foreign scholarships.
What I'm saying is that.
That's where the bulk of the
problem is. You see, the foreign scholarships. Kofi is proposing that we should scrap it.
Yes.
No, that's what you are proposing. And you see, I agree with you on that. The reason being that, as we speak, many embassies and institutions outside Ghana even provide foreign scholarships. So it answers the question of exposure. So when you go to Hungary, for example, every year, the Hungarian government gives out a number of slots for scholarships. The Indian government does that. The Chinese government is doing that because they want to give Ghanaians exposure.
We should leave the foreign ones to these bodies.
So these amounts of money, this huge sum that you are investing in sponsoring party apparatus and supporting people to go and
travel, and then even on the local scholarships.
Sponsoring people who never assess the course, but they take the money, put that into local scholars at the district assembly level.
Very well.
So that everybody will have access to quality education.
Okay.
At the tertiary level.
Great. Amprofi, very few words on this. I'll let Kokro conclude this because he is from the ruling party. Very few words on the scholarship bonanza story, if you have anything to say on this one.
Well, just two sentences. I think we should all be very, very much ashamed. Going forward, let's have a radical overhaul of this system. Both parties have really benefited from this. Pure example of what seat capture can do. We need to have, probably as an additional layer to what Kofi mentioned, let's have a training needs of even the people who are going on this training. Because I see that people have backgrounds in, let's say, political science. Why would you want to go and do a master's degree in political science again? And how does that fit into what we need? What are the skills gaps in the country, you know? So we should be ashamed. The earlier we tackle this, the better. Those are just facts.
Very well. Kokro, you have a final word on this.
Yeah, my final word is I want to congratulate this my friend here, Kofi Asare, Africa Education, what they are doing very well. You see, we have a pragmatic system, a progressive society. When you see challenges, you proffer solutions. Mm. You don't go to do on a tangent or propaganda. And I think that you're doing very well. Today, I want to encourage you, stay focused. And then, as you like data. I don't like conjecture. I want people to speak to data. And today, you are speaking to issues. Mm. Let us also put on record that scholarships are not for students, belong by needy students alone. Mm. Let us put it on record. Civil servants can access scholarship. You know, I have said it on many platforms that we need HR policy in Ghana. Mm. If you don't have a clear-cut national HR policy, these are the issues that will confront the national scholarship secretariat.
But you do admit that a lot of these scholarships, as we have seen, have, they were given based on nepotic and political.
No. You see,
some of them did not even
know it. To me, I've been saying something that I don't follow conjectures. Mm. Because there's statutes there. When the MPP formed government in 2017, there was decentralization of the scholarship scheme. Mm. And Mr. Kofi Asare alluded to
it. And notwithstanding that we are seeing this.
So the report by Fourth Estate of the Realm, to me, it's not anything so that all scholarships will be given to privileged people in the society. But what we need to get it this afternoon or this morning on your network is we should stop this when one person is in government, we talk too much, and then the same people who are ranting, you see them at the scholarship secretariat queuing, that they should give them opportunities to go and read some programs.
Essentially, you agree with the suggestions.
Because you see me. I've been saying it on many platforms that the reform that we have brought is good, but we need to deepen it. You know, Africa Education will talk about legislation on scholarship.
Mm. And you think it's a great idea?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, that it's a pragmatic suggestion.
So maybe government will have to. The private members will decide. The president will look at it.
Says something. There's no state capture at the scholarship secretariat.
Okay.
If you do forensic audit, everybody, you see some names there who are not politicians. Journalists are there. Many top people. You see, when you want to do needs assessment, we should not think that today my brilliant friend Kofi Asare is the executive director of an NGO, so he doesn't have some needs.
Very well.
You understand? We should be very careful.
Very well.
We should go the tangent of Mr. Asare.
Good.
That we need a clear-cut legislation to be able to
govern. So when you go to your meeting, you re-echo his suggestions.
Government has the JLMI, Ghana Labour Market Information System. And government has the national skills strategy. Government has a skills anticipation system. So the Ministry of Employment, they know the skills.
Welcome back. This is a big issue, very heated discussion on this matter, even as we were on break. But we want to transition, we want to move to the next matter, which is the cocoa producer, the cocoa pricing issue. Government and the opposition have been at each other's throat. Government, I mean the cocoa board, which is the body responsible for all of that producer price. Government saying that they're treating cocoa farmers quite well. Opposition saying no, they are being shortchanged, etc. Given what pertains to the world market and all of that, cocoa board saying that what our farmers get is almost the best, or compares positively or favorably to what happens in the sub-region. This is a matter for discussion. But apart from everything, the cocoa sector appears to be struggling because of factors such as diseases, galamsey, and all of that. So my guests on this segment, Asiedu Kokro, again, Deputy National Communications Director of the MPP, Edem Agbana as well, parliamentary candidate for Ketuna for the NDC, Fifi Boafu, Director of Public Affairs for Cocoa Board, and also Kofi Asare, who actually is Executive Director of Africa Education Watch, but is also a cocoa farmer, which means that he knows the issues practically, so that when Fifi Boafu is talking about policy and all of that, he knows what's on the ground, and Agbanati will be dealing with what his side has uncovered, and Kokoro will be helping us understand.
No, but if you speak, okay, great. No problem.
So Fifi, welcome to the program. You've been in the news this week for, you know, some of the usual issues, the price, you know, and all of that. NDC saying that they may shortchange, etc. But give us a quick picture of the sector as it is in relation with production, the numbers in terms of tonnage, and also how much we pay our cocoa farmers compares with what people in the sub-region, Côte d'Ivoire, etc., get.
Well, thank you very much, Salom. And hello to the guest on the show. So cocoa pricing usually in Ghana, I'm referring to determining the producer price of cocoa farmers, it's done beginning of the season, and then it continues to the next season. But this time around, something has changed. And what has changed is that halfway, a new price has been announced. And the reason for announcing a new price is to ensure that we are able to get all the cocoa possible and forward it to the traders we've signed contracts with. The major reason why we've seen this change is because production generally is low across the globe. This year, we've seen the worst in terms of production of cocoa in the world, because the two major producers of cocoa, Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana, we are experiencing a very bad weather condition. The El Nino effect has hit very hard this time, and our production numbers are not looking great. So what has happened is, between Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, we usually sell forward. And when I say forward, what I mean is that we sign contract with buyers, and then during in the course of the cocoa season, we deliver the cocoa to the buyers after taking delivery from the licensed buying companies who buy from the cocoa farmers. So we've signed some contracts with a certain expectations as to how much cocoa we expect to produce. Beginning of the season, the realization is that the numbers are not what we anticipated they were going to be, and various forecasts have indicated that the production numbers are not looking great for the two biggest producers of cocoa. Of course, other producing countries are equally having their own challenges. Ecuador, for example, are also having an issue. Malaysia have their own issue as well. So the numbers are not looking great. So there is a shortage on the market. That shortage on the market has forced the price to see a record level. I remember about a month and a half ago, I was with a former colleague who is within the space of trading. And we saw the cocoa price jump from $4,000 a ton to $4,700. And there's a gentleman who has spent his entire life trading cocoa, and he says it's the most ridiculous thing he's ever seen on the market. And he never for a second thought that that would happen. After a month and a half or 2 months down the line, we've seen the price move from 4,000 to as high as 10,000 at a point in time. So we all admit that there is shortage. It is difficult for producing countries to have cocoa available to sell on the spot, because all cocoa available will largely be used to fulfill contracts already signed. So that has pushed price. So there are people within the chain. These are not your cocoa board or Le Conseil de Café Cacao or the regular traders, but these are people who are now buying cocoa from Ghana farmers, or even some of the licensed buying companies, smuggle it out of the country and able to sell it to buyers at the current spot price. And that's very limited. So this limited cocoa, they are taking advantage. It is happening to Ghana, it is happening to Côte d'Ivoire. And in Côte d'Ivoire, for example, the military is highly involved in ensuring that cocoa going out of the country, they deal with it. It is smuggled to countries like Guinea, to Liberia, and interestingly to Burkina Faso, and then some of the cocoa actually come from Ghana as well. So realizing that, yes, even though we have committed the cocoa to contracts, and we do not have excess cocoa coming in apart from what we have already committed to contracts, there will also be the need to also adjust the price, because one critical need we are trying to address is the fact that people now know, it strikes knowledge that the world market is very high, and when we are starting the next cocoa season, the cocoa price will be increased. So what they do is that they buy the cocoa from the cocoa farmers. Some of the LBCs will do that. There are some business people who buy it from the farmers and keep it. When they keep the cocoa, when the price is announced in October this year, then they will submit the cocoa at the new price. So the farmer will be disadvantaged. Cocoa board will also be disadvantaged. And for cocoa board, it's not just the price and also our ability to get the cocoa to deliver the contracts we have signed. But the cocoa will come in, it will be moldy, they will mix it with new cocoa, and it affects our quality. So the decision was, why don't you increase the price now, be able to get the cocoa, it will come at a cost, but we'll be able to get the cocoa at least to give it to the people you have signed contracts with as you prepare towards the next cocoa season. And this is the reason why we are here at this point.
I see. Quite interesting. And so you attribute the problems we are facing now to the forced sale of the commodity and all of that. What would be your direct response to claims that you are shortchanging the farmers? So, for example, the government's share of the sale is over 70%. When a farmer who does the work itself gets just around 20 or 25%. Given that the world market price per ton today is $10,000 and it at an exchange rate of 1:3 and all of those calculations that were made, will you attribute all of this to the point you make about the forward sale of the commodity?
Okay, so Solomon, the argument those people make is that Cocoa Board is realizing 10,000 and Cocoa Board is giving 20% of it to the farmer. Anyone who paid attention to the explanation made in this conversation, you realize that you already have contracts to deliver. So you are not delivering the cocoa based on the current price because you've sold forward. So if you use the 10,000 as a basis to advance any argument, then the very foundation of your argument is wrong and you will get it wrong. So there's no reason for you to even advance the cost unless it for mischief purposes. So that whole argument, and indeed, it is funny when you hear people who make those arguments say that, oh, of course, that's how much is paid to the cocoa farmer and the remaining amount is paid to government or is paid to cocoa board. They don't even factor in the license buying companies, what the margins they get. They do not even factor in the cost of shipment. They do not factor in haulage to the ports and all other industry costs and make the claim that that is how much government is taken and the money is with cocoa board. That is just not right, and that is not a genuine way of addressing an issue. But as I said, we are not even there because if, for example, cocoa board, we have said that, okay, we are doing a forward sale of 600,000 of our cocoa. Our expectation is that we'll make 800,000. Then you have the opportunity that the remaining 200,000, you are able to take advantage of the current spot price and make some money out of it. But in a situation where you are not even making the numbers you anticipated, how are you able to sell spot to make extra revenue, which they are using as basis for the argument? So you realize that it is not, they're actually creating the impression that, so today, Cocoa Board does not have any commitment. We do not have any forward sale contracts. And the cocoa coming in is actually being sold on the spot, and Cocoa Board is realizing the amount of money which we have on the spot. And one way in which we also need to even address our minds to is the fact that the price that is seen on the internet, it's actually a spot price. What a spot price basically means is that, so today Cocoa Board has cocoa, Barry Callebaut or Cargill or Olam is interested. So we sign a contract that, yes, we'll deliver you X tonnage of cocoa, and that tonnage of cocoa is delivered to you and you pay that amount. This is cocoa that will be bought from now to September. And they are saying that, so cocoa probably you deliver in September. If you use the today's price, what they do not tell you, or what they do not make the people aware, or maybe it is not everyone who understands the nitty-gritties of the trading system. What they do not realize is that cocoa contract that is signed today, for a contract, for the execution of the contract, say in September, there's the price for September execution, and the price is not the same as a contract executed today. So they will even use that as a basis to say that because of that, you are cheating the farmer. Let me give you an example. So we are doing forward sales today. You see the spot price at 10,000 today. It is basically because you don't have cocoa available. There are people who are interested in getting cocoa today. So they are signing contracts at, say, 10,000 or 9,000. Today, markets, if you are signing a contract to deliver cocoa May next year, how much you realize is 4,700, because the market predicts that rainfall pattern is improving in Ghana and in Cote d'Ivoire. So going forward, the crop will be better. So if to deliver a contract May next year, there will be a lot of cocoa on the market. So the buyer will not pay 10,000 for it. And then how much you realize is 4,700. So if the person is saying that even though you are signing a contract today, you will deliver or execute the contract in May next year, you are still supposed to pay the farmer 10,000. How would cocoa world be able to do that? They are not addressing that. My final point on this is that there are those who have said, well, then after all, the forward contracts are not good. Today, it makes every sense to say that the forward contracts are not good because we are in an abnormal market. In an abnormal market, you probably will say that the forward contracts are the best way out. But if you look at the trajectory over the years, you will realize that there is a reason for the forward sales. So today the market is around 10,000. It will interest you to know that the entire month of February, because the price is so high, Cocoa Board was only able to sell 23 tons of cocoa. So if the argument is that, wait, keep everything, sell only when the price is high, and then in a month, Cocoa Board would only be able to sell 23 tons of cocoa. How would we sell the cocoa and be able to pay the farmers and other commitments?
I see.
And one of the key reasons why we do forward sales is also to spread risk. We spread risk because if you keep all your cocoa, immediately you start selling. So, for example, Ghana is keeping all the cocoa. Cote d'Ivoire is also keeping their cocoa. The market will be able to predict that because Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire will be selling at a particular point in time, at that time on the market, you have over 3 million metric tons of cocoa available. Do you think we'll be seeing the price we see today? No. It is to help us to be able to have a price for the farmer, which we can say that, okay, based on the forward sales done and the market trends, this is how much we believe the farmer will be able to realize. So a price is determined. It is to insulate the farmers from the fluctuations we see on the market. But today, the fact that, well, the market has seen something abnormal happening, it gives room for people to question. Of course, even ourselves at Cocoa Board, there have been series of arguments as to whether or not forward sales is the best way. But if you do the analysis, we believe that you cannot keep all your cocoa available and say that wait when the price is good, that's when you only sell. That will surely give room for your partners to at least outwit you on the market.
All right, great. Kofi, a quick one. You are a cocoa farmer. Will you say that given all that you've heard and everything, you are getting your labor's worth? I mean, what you put in, you as a farmer, are you benefiting from the resource the way it's reasonably expected that you will benefit?
Well, once you are in the cocoa industry, downstream, your only market is government, so you don't have any option, right? Whether you're better off or not, I mean, you're already locked up in the industry. I just wanted to conclude what Fifi just said by adding that. So if you do this forward sale based on your anticipation, and it so happens that by the end of the year, of the year for which you have forward sale selling, you are able to get a price, you know, a price that is either higher than your predicted or projected price, okay? It makes a lot of sense for you to pay, to top up what you give to farmers earlier on, because you are predicting. You understand that the price might drop compared to the recent one. And so you're not going to give farmers X amount, X percentage. That's fine. You do the forward sale. You are hedging against losses. That's fine. But then, in the same way, if at the end of that period of prediction, you are able to get a price higher than anticipated, it makes a lot of sense if you top up to farmers. Mm. Then you are just not mitigating against risk by using the forward sale approach, but also you are also securing the interest of the farmer when there is a windfall. That is something that I want to chip in for further discussion on how to improve this forward sale approach. The sector is suffering. I mean, and I'm not surprised, not particularly to Ghana, but also Cote d'Ivoire. What Fifi spends his time talking about the pricing and all that. That's good. And then the global output is down for, yes. Once production falls in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, it will affect global output because we are the two main, you know. Everything I will explain sums up as climate change. Climate change, climate vagaries is what's affecting the cocoa sector. Just like it is affecting other aspects of agri. We have a situation where rainfall patterns have become irregular and non-traditional. And so if the rain falls at the wrong time, it affects the crops. You know, and I speak from my cocoa and then my vegetable background. Once the plants start flowering and the rain comes in at the wrong time, it deflowers the plants. Mm. Once the plant is deflowered, you don't have anything left. You understand? So irregular rainfall patterns or unanticipated rainfall patterns that has led to a situation where you are having more rain at the wrong time and it brings fungal infections. Mm. That is why swollen shoot is the major problem. And once you get into the swollen shoot business, you have to cut your tree. Our government is supporting replanting, but it hasn't been all that rosy. There's been serious challenges. Sometimes you transplant in the replanting process, and then, you know, the climate change again begins to affect the new replanting. So survival rate is not, you know, as encouraging as we expected on our farm. So there are serious issues with climate change, you know, manifesting in various ways within the cocoa sector. But apart from the climate change issue, there's also the major issue of profitability. And I'm coming to the first question you asked me. We have gotten to a point, where I'm talking about, if I say we, you know, myself and my dad and my brother, we are partners in the field. To the point where it makes sense to diversify and begin investing in rubber. And that's what we've been doing for the past 3 years. Because if you look at how much we are getting for output, I mean per acre, given this climate change is reducing your output per hectare to, let's say, about only 8 or 9 bucks instead of minimum of 15 bucks. Mm. Okay? Then you are having only a quarter of WMP, what bucket price, being paid to you. Okay? About 2,000 cedis. If you compare what you are getting from all these troubles to the rubber sector, where there is an open market, there's a free market, so let me put it that way, and that the buyer is not the one who determines how much they'll buy my products, but I determine how much I'll sell my products. Okay, investment in rubber provides a useful alternative like road. So we started investing in rubber 2.5 years ago. Mm. Many cocoa farmers are beginning to invest in rubber, especially in the Wassa areas. Many cocoa farmers are beginning to invest in rubber. And once you are seeing investments shift into rubber because they think, you know, there's more value for money and profitability and all that, and relatively lower impact of climate change, you know, etc., you're going to be having declining output. So the declining output is as a result of mixed bag, decreasing profitability relative to other opportunities available in building rubber. And then also the climate change and its implication on disease and then, you know, crop survival rate and then yield and all that.
And there's also the part about Galamsey, small scale mining.
Oh, Galamsey is the third one. Mm. Okay. So the environmental factors are two, the climate change and then the Galamsey. Mm. People are
people, because of the low yield occasioned by the swollen shoot, and until recently, the low cost, a lot of people were, you know, in those areas were ready to give up their farms for cash. Took them serious. I mean, we've read so many reports of them. It is real, especially in the area I'm talking about, where mining is heavy, in the Wasa area, where illegal mining is heavy. So it's a mixed bag. These three factors, you know, is culminating in the declining yield that we are seeing. A lot more research, a lot more investment is required to resuscitate the sector and make it more resilient in the coming years.
I see.
But it tells all of us that the animal called climate change we read about every day, it's not too far.
It's biting,
it's
really.
It's actually arrived, exactly. And we need to take adequate mitigating strategies to protect our climate and also strengthen climate resilience.
I see. This is the big issue. The second segment of the program, we're dealing with the matters of cocoa producer price and the factors affecting, or the fact that the issues involved in the decline of cocoa production, etc. We've dealt with the forward sale of it, whether that is the way to go, but it does appear that's what we have to be doing until further notice. Kofi just talked about disease, climate change, galamse, etc. They're smuggling too. But I'll take a short break. When I come back, I'll hear from Edem and perhaps Kokro, who has actually waived his right to and giving it to
some cocoa politics
and giving it to
Fifi. Academic work.
So we'll take a short break. We'll come back, and I want Fifi to tell us what impact smuggling is had on the sector, and then to I'm sure we'll deal with our that. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll deal with this on the final lap. Don't go away. All right, welcome back to the big issue, the final lap of it, dealing with cocoa producer price and factors affecting the decline of cocoa production. A number of factors have been named, environmental factors, climate change, etc., and all of that, the pricing, profitability. Kofi says that, you know, all of that is affecting everything. So Amprofu is on. Edem Agbanaz is speaking, and then we'll get Fifi to conclude on that. All right, Edem, so quickly on your thoughts on why we are having difficulties in the cocoa sector. The producer price, some farmers say they are not getting value for money, but Kofi just explained it, but let me know what you think. And also, why you think that there's decline in the production.
Well, Salom, our position as a political party, the NDC, is that the government is actually shortchanging our gallant cocoa farmers, people who sacrifice so much for this country. And that is the reason why many of them are now engaged in what we call smuggling. Because if you can get your produce or your cocoa beans to a neighboring country and sell it at a higher price, certainly after all the suffering and investment in your farm, and they know how it is being sold in neighboring countries, they'll be more interested in doing that than selling it to their only buyer, which happens to be the government. And so smuggling is part of the reasons why the cocoa yield is really on a sharp decline. I know there are concerns of climate change, all of those ones are natural factors that are there, but we cannot deny the fact that because the farmers are not getting value for money, many of them now are engaged in the smuggling and all of that. Kofi has explained that he is now diversifying into
rubber.
The production of rubber. It is because he wants value for his investment. So when you are invested in cocoa and you are not getting the value, and government seems to be ripping off the cocoa farmer, most of the farmers may take the decision.
And I'll tell you, it's not
a rip off, because we are making comparisons. And when you compare Ghana cities for
a bag
of the cocoa beans, it's that amount constitutes over 65% of
the actual price of cocoa. And so that was their percentage that they were earning. But as we speak today, the 2,070 Ghana cedis per bag, which the government wants us to celebrate, only constitutes 25.47% of the actual price per bag in the international market, meaning over 75% of the price is going into cocoa board, the government, and all these other levies that they're talking about. Now, if I were a cocoa farmer and I see how the sector is being mismanaged, where board members of cocoa board, in addition to phones and laptops, tablets being bought for them by cocoa board, even keypad.
They said those have not been bought.
No,
the keypads and all of that.
But there was a memo to that effect. Yeah, it wasn't rejected. That memo had passed through the hands of about six different directors.
Yeah, but
eighth person or so that leaked it. It's not being bought. It was approved. But for the fact that it had leaked, Selom, it have been bought.
Yeah, so we have saved money. So we have
saved, because they were caught. You see, let me give you this simple analogy. Because when you're talking about cocoa, I want the people to appreciate what the issues are. So a thief breaks into your house to steal your belongings, okay? Then in the process of stealing, your security person raises an alarm, the thief is arrested, and the thief wants to be celebrated that I didn't have not stolen. I was only in the process.
I'm not sure about the analogy.
You have written a memo.
You said it was useful for their work.
Useful how? You see, Selom, when we provide justifications for this naked thievery, we encourage people to steal from the public purse without shame. That you mean people who qualify to be appointed as members of cocoa board, to be members of that board, cannot use their own tablets or phones to do their work. That when it becomes a working tool, even keypad for tablets, cocoa board must use the cocoa farmers' money that must go into buying the cocoa beans from them. You give them only 25.47% of what they deserve, and you are mismanaging the rest at the cocoa board office, buying keypads worth 4,500 Ghana cedis, and you think that we need to celebrate them for what? You see, at the end of the day, those who are not the cocoa farmers, those who are not farmers, those who pretend to be managing the sector are the ones benefiting more than the ordinary cocoa farmer. And this is what we are talking about. The truth is that this forward sales and explanations of sale. I'm happy he himself made an admission that when you're talking about forward sales, it involves taking some risk. Is that not it?
And it is a risk.
It's a risk.
Many other things.
So he's projecting that by May next year, the figures the prices may come down to about 4,700. Is that not it? What it means is that even before the season, so he himself alluded to the fact that usually the pricing is done before the commencement of the season. But they would have to be, this time around, they have broken into the, how do I call it, their timing or their schedule, because of the price increments. Now, if you are giving the farmers only 25% of what they deserve, and your explanation is that because you are doing forward sales, you are trying to mitigate against a certain risk, the question that we should be asking ourselves is that same risk is not only cocoa board, it is not only the government. In fact, if there is anyone that must bear, that must be the biggest risk taker, it must be the farmer. So you must cushion them by giving them at least 60% of what they deserve. So when the price falls and then the prices of cocoa per bag reduces, the farmer will know that in the season
the spot market price today may not necessarily apply because they have sold it already. They've sold it in the past. They sold it forward. So that spot price, which is 10,000 today, will not apply to what we have now because you've sold it already. So calculating it based on the spot market price may not be accurate.
Last year, November, recall that there was this cocoa debate all over. And then at the time, the minority in parliament, led by the Honorable Eric Opoku, exposed cocoa board for what we call the diversity in the pricing scheme. So they don't only use the forward sales. But let's even assume that they only use the forward sales. Here is the case. You are claiming that you are mitigating against a certain risk. And I'm saying that if there is anyone that must be cushioned in terms of the risk, it's the cocoa farmer.
Very well.
So let the government admit that the 2070, which constitutes only 25.47% of the price that the cocoa farmers
you want that raise to
a rip
60,
off.
You want that raise to 60%.
It is a complete rip off.
Very well.
At the end of the season, at the end of the year, when we were able to assess the risk, which was anticipated, assess its real impact, if there's a windfall,
then
the farmers must benefit. Exactly. You understand? Yeah. Because the risk shouldn't be only for government.
Also, exactly. That's exactly what we are saying. So it's a rip-off. It's a rip-off to
I think Vivi and Co will disagree. Imani has done some work on cocoa profitability, etc. Unfortunately, Amprofi Ajiman is here to assist us understand what Imani has done in respect of this. Amprofi, what can you tell us about what Imani has done in respect of the subject?
Okay, so we carried out some work in certain sectors, regions of cocoa producing areas. We basically looked at how models of cocoa being used in Ghana can actually affect profitability. Now, maybe let me just put this in the context because we're talking about climate change, galamse, and smuggling. What the intervention show is that there has to be there's a requirement of more investment. Let's say when you take high-tech cocoa production, for example, are farmers able to really invest in high-tech cocoa production, which has shown to sort of somehow serve as a good adaptation measure for some of the impact of climate change? That we are not very sure. We know that some models are more prone to climate change than others. Now, the question is whether the government will be able to fund these, because when you have full sun models, converting or full sun model, converting that to whether to shaded models or agroforestry kind of model, it needs certain inputs, it needs certain investments and all that. Whether or not we'll be able to do that, that's also another thing. And our aspect of our study also looked at galamsey as well. And I'm sure we should probably also be thinking about what the EU is thinking about all of this, the EU due diligence law, which has been passed and all that, looking at how they are likely to take certain actions against cocoa producing countries, which have been seen to either support deforestation or child labor. These are some of the things we also have to look at. Now, as a point of trying incentivizing cocoa farmers, I'm not sure whether the new producer price would be incentive enough. I mean, it's early days yet. Whether it would be incentive enough for the farmers not to actually facilitate smuggling. And in relation to that, probably maybe just pose a question to Fifi. Sorry to take your role, but what happened to the living income differential? Because we're talking about a couple of years ago, I know Ivory Coast and Ghana sort of teamed up to put up the living income differential. I'm not sure if that really worked out well, or what the feasibility studies on that was, if it hasn't, and whether it's going to be reintroduced. And probably a last question, is the producer price going to shoot up in the next cocoa season? Are we expected to think that is going to be the case? Because farmers have to be incentivized enough so that, you know, we'll be able to have a good posture and to deal with all these challenges that we are facing currently.
All right, great. Great. Thanks. So Imani is asking us to be mindful of the EU due diligence concerns and also what the living income differential, you know, markets should be. If you will answer that. Kukuru, just a few seconds to do your cocoa policies, as you called it.
Yeah, I think that the cocoa farmer is not worse off, as my dear friend Adam wants the Ghanaian people to believe. If you look at the quantum jump, it's very, very significant. Mm. It's very, very significant, looking at how we have been able to. And indeed, the NDC, they are going around with some hammer formula. And I think that Fifi is on the line, so I will leave it to him for each other who expose them. You know, consistently, they have been looking at the spot market price. It's not done like that. It's not that. It's deliberate mischief that they are doing. Yeah, Mahama, they have circulated some Mahama formula. Fifi, explain that because you are here, so I don't want to take much time. Now, the farmer is not worse off because I've seen some NDC young men displaying
some cement bags analysis. Then I like figures, so usually when I see figures, and I also do some analysis. In 2016, the bag of the cement was 475, and then a bag of cement was 30 Ghana cedis. You can buy 15 bags, approximately about 15 bags. 2024, what is the bag? 2,070 per bag. You can buy 21 bags. So
how much is the price of cement now?
You see, I will teach you statistics. Yeah, after a year, I will teach you statistics.
But
how much is the price of cement? Yeah. No. It's 95. And you can afford
95.
Don't be mischief, I beg you. You see, it's 95. And you can buy 21. So in nominal terms, still the farmer is better than the NDC who are shouting on the fence. In nominal terms. My friend is also
in large figures.
Oh, who tells you?
In reduced statistics.
Yeah, in real terms. In real terms. Because 2016, 475 per bag was able to buy 15 bucks.
It's not. This is voodoo. This is voodoo.
Yeah, statistics. They will not. Yeah, they will not.
I'll tell you why.
When this
calculation is ridiculous.
They publish it in the villages and we're exposing them. He said, voodoo mathematics.
Should I tell you why?
Okay, give me why.
Should I tell you why it is ridiculous?
Yeah, tell me.
Kofi, I am buying an item from you. Then the price in the market is about 8,000.
I'm giving you, you can't tell me that because
how much you are offering you can buy me more bags of cement.
Let me proceed.
You can afford to steal me.
The pricing is not done based on cement.
He's talking about the real value. The pricing is not done on cement.
Yeah, the pricing is done on the international market.
Just for cement.
For cement.
And I'm saying that the pricing is not done based on why? Do you price cocoa based on cement?
I'm not talking about.
So it is voodoo statistics.
Let me put also this on record.
I also want to talk about purchasing power. We can go into that. But this is voodoo statistics.
The only thing that is analysis, I subscribe to this analysis.
Fantastic.
Because I buy cement and I allow this fuel. And I have a point where the 2015 versus the 4 whatever it is in 2016. Yes, in terms of real value of the money I'm getting.
Yes,
I was buying more fuel today. But I recognize that in 2016,
you let me make this.
I was getting free.
Prices increasing in twice a year within the NDC region. They never increase twice in the NDC.
How is that an achievement?
You have just 1 minute. Deal with the matter of smuggling for us. And how you are trying to deal with it. And the income and the living income differential, which was promised in your manifesto. Just deal with this position for me.
All right. Thank you very much. A lot of misinformation spilled by Eden with all confidence, and then also using flights of friendly and unfortunately there's some abusive words, and I think they are not useful for special conversations. So he said that smuggling is happening for farmers to benefit. The beneficiaries of smuggling are not farmers. But these are people who largely have been identified, sometimes are not even Ghanaians. So he doesn't probably even understand what he's talking about by saying that the people benefited from the smuggling are the cocoa farmers. He said in 2016, the price was 475 and today 2070. And the farmer is worse off because he used the percentage. What it does not tell you is that in 2000, the figure he quoted or the percentage is out of the achieved FOB. Achieved FOB in 2006. If we do the percentage, the achieved FOB today is not 10,000. The achieved FOB is 2,600. So if you actually do a percentage of it, it means 93% and not 20%. He doesn't understand. So you should stop abusing people with such words. He says Cocoa Board has bought phones for board members. That's a lie. Cocoa Board has not bought phones for board members. I then proceed to say that it is thievery because keepers have been bought for board members. And he says six directors have signed. Who are these six directors? He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, so we've seen your statement. We've seen your statement from Cocoa Board. I mean, refuting that. All right. So we'll have more time to deal with this. This is a big issue. My name is Selam Adunu. Thanks so much for doing the viewing and listening. Have a good afternoon.